Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is the perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through.
Hello, folks, and thank you once again for coming to Bard's Logic Political Talk, part of the growing conservative conversation and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And you can find the Patriot Journalist Network by going to www.patriotjournalist.com. And I just came from there. They have a Twitter event on tonight regarding Benghazi. And so everyone there, I'd like to say hi to those in the audience. So hello from Patriot Journalist Network. And also check out the Bard's Logic Political Talk website at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com, and check out the different pages on there, including the Give page, where we have some wonderful organizations and some political groups that do need your financial help. So thank you very much from them and from me for any contribution that you can do to their cause. And tonight is a special episode of Bard's Logic here on Friday night. Thank you, everyone, for listening, whether you're listening here live on the show or listening to the archive, welcome. And you can call in later on to talk to our guest and our panelists at 347-945-7428. But first, we will have our interview with the U.S. Congressional Tea Party candidate, David Hale. And without any further ado, I will open up his mic and welcome him. Thank you very much, David, for coming into the show. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for coming on tonight as well. I know you have your primary there in Illinois is on the 18th, so we want to wish you luck on that. And I know you've got a very busy schedule next week ahead of you. So first, though, give us a little, tell us a little bit about yourself to start off with, some of your background, experience, things of that nature. So let's go ahead and start with there.
Sure, absolutely. How long do you have?
Wow, we've got 3 hours.
So I joined the United States Army when I was 17 years old, and I spent 3 years in the U.S. Army. And after the Army, I did my 3 years in the individual ready reserves and went to, did some community college after that. And subsequently, I ended up working in the aviation business, and I worked in commercial aviation. I worked for some manufacturers. I worked as a military contractor on helicopters. I was a crew chief in the Army, so that's where I got the experience. And along the way, I got a license to fix airplanes granted by the FAA, and then I got my private pilot's license. I never flew commercially, but I did learn how to fly, so that was kind of fun flying those little those little fixed-wing airplanes. They're kind of scary. You keep thinking the wing is going to break off every time a wind gust comes along. Then after that, I spent about 18, 20 years doing that, and after that my son was born, and I was 36 when my son was born. He had a brain tumor, and found out after 3 months he had a brain tumor. His eyes kind of did something weird, and ended up taking him to the hospital. He had a CAT scan, showed a brain tumor, and he had to have surgery. So here's my son at 3 months old, through one of the worst possible predicaments and situations you could possibly be in. fighting for his life at 3 months old. And so he went through the surgery, and as I was in the hospital, I looked around at this amazing infrastructure of American medicine and what we had built as a people. And I considered myself a Christian. I still do. And at the time, though, I hadn't really served much, and I had not really made the connection between service and Christianity. And I subsequently looked at this amazing infrastructure of medicine and said, look at these folks serving all around me, helping me, helping my son, and, making it so there's hope and catering to our every need and just serving, And I said, I need to learn how to serve. And so I decided to go and become a registered nurse, and I'd already had a degree in journalism, and so I went back to school and got my degree in nursing and became a trauma nurse in the state of Illinois and worked as a clinical trauma nurse in emergency rooms for 8 years. And as a trauma nurse, I seen the worst of humanity and the best of humanity. It's a different experience in an ED and an ER than you can possibly imagine in any other environment. I had gotten my EMT license, and that was still a very different experience than being that nurse caring for people for extended periods of time and, watching them live and die, saving lives, and unfortunately seeing people die and the impact of that. And so that's, where I ended up was in nursing, and that's where I found my niche when it came to service, and that's what I will bring to Congress with me if I ever make it, if I make it to Congress. That's what I want to bring to Congress with me, is this desire to serve and this desire to see people have opportunity to get better, to have a better life. And, that's just pretty much what I'm all about, and that's pretty much my background.
Okay, great. Thank you. And that definitely would bring a unique, well, maybe not unique, but a rare perspective in the House of Representatives for sure. But also one of the things you're known for is what you did there when some senators showed up in your state, kind of ditching their job. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was pretty fun. So I do a lot of social media, and I had a friend. Let me back up a little bit. At the time, what had happened was in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Senate refused to listen to a bill that Scott Walker had helped to bring through their House of Representatives. And that bill essentially said, listen, we're going to reduce the ability of unions, in particular public employee unions, not private employee unions, but public employee unions, to negotiate, the collective bargaining, negotiate through collective bargaining. We're going to reduce that ability because we don't believe that it's fair. Unions, public employee unions, who are being paid by public tax dollars, we don't think it's fair that they should put taxpayers over a barrel to pay them to commit themselves to doing the service that they say they're going to do. So he passed this bill through the House up there, and Wisconsin is 13 miles across the border from me. And it got to the Senate over there, and they were about to pass it in the Senate because they had a slight majority in the Senate up there. And the senators from the other side, from the Democrat Party, they decided to leave, and if they left, they wouldn't have a quorum. And without having a quorum, they couldn't pass that bill and then put it on Scott Walker's desk to sign. So they left, and they came across the border. It was, Madison is about an hour and a half away, but the Wisconsin border is about 15 minutes away. So they came across the border to my little town. And at the time, I was Tea Party leader. I still prior to that, I was a Tea Party leader for about 2 years. I came across the border, and they hit out at this place called the Clock Tower Inn. And on social media, I had a friend ping me, and he said, hey, those senators, they fled, and they're up at the Clock Tower Inn. And I was like, oh, wow, interesting. So I just went up there. I'd been following the story. I went up there, and all I wanted to do was get some video that I could post on social media of me asking these guys a tough question, why aren't you doing your job, challenging them to get their job done. And I caught up to them. They were actually swamped by the media. The media had been keeping a lid on it. The media had known about them being there and had not told anybody. And the media was all over the place. They had helicopters and everything up there. And so I arrived at the end of one of the interviews that the media was doing with them and asked them the question. I put it out on my social media, and it went viral. And the next thing I know, I was on Cavuto. I was on Fox News. I was on I didn't talk to Rush, but he was talking all about it. He was happy about it. And all the major talk shows and all the TV shows, and didn't make it to CNN. I think they kind of ignored it. But the YouTube video actually, in within 24 hours of it going viral, had 130,000 views.
Wow!
So I was down usually around 50 or 60 views for some of the videos I would put out there. That one went 230,000. So it was a pretty interesting time. After that, the Daily Show called me, and I ended up on the Daily Show. And they sent out one of their correspondent, I forget the gentleman's name now, Elliot or something. He was really fun. And so they did a segment in the Daily Show about it.
Huh. That's pretty cool. I believe I remember the issue. I remember that going on. And I do remember a little bit. I might have even seen that show that you're referring to. That was definitely pretty interesting. So we'll get back. We'll get to the meat and potatoes now of your campaign, starting with that. And you are challenging Adam Kinzinger in the Republican primary for the U.S. Congress in the 16th District of Illinois. Would you say that your opponent is an establishment Republican? And if so, what has he done to draw this conclusion?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I get that asked a lot. He is an establishment Republican. Absolutely, he's been in the Illinois House, well, not the Illinois House, but the U.S. House of Representatives now for 3 years. He did a term where he defeated an incumbent Democrat in another district. We had some redistricting go on, and he then subsequently won that seat in a primary against a very highly respected gentleman by the name of Don Manzullo. And so he's been in office now for about 3 years, and he likes to say that he's got fresh ideas, but his ideas are really a rehash of the same thing that we as conservatives have seen over and over and over again. And I haven't seen any fresh ideas come out of the Republican Party as of late, with probably for the last 10 or 15 years. And this is just, it's just a rehash of those same old ideas, nothing fresh about them. And indeed, he is an establishment Republican. He's a whip. He's a House whip, so he's in the leadership. And essentially, he does what John Boehner asks him to do.
Well, that's actually a pretty good segue to the next question, because I did read an article and where you could tell that Kinzinger is basically a yes man. So we could tell us and give us more about your observation, giving us details and some examples on that.
Yeah. He has always voted for the debt limit increases. He has never not voted to raise the debt limit, except for this last time in February. He voted against it, and he voted against it because he knows that he's got a challenge in this district with conservatives through my candidacy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he feels me nipping at his heels, even though really at the end of the day, I'm just kind of a twerp, compared to this guy, because he's nationally known. He gets national attention continuously, which I don't understand how a three-year congressman is getting such national attention continuously. But, you know, he feels me at his heels. So he voted against the debt limit increase. Otherwise, if I wasn't there, he would have voted for that debt limit increase. And he's voted for the budget. He voted for this last budget. And this last budget added $1.012 trillion to our debt. And so essentially what that means is that we're deficit spending again for the next year in our budget. We're deficit spending by $1.012 trillion. And anything in the deficit gets added to the debt because there's nowhere else for it to go. So we essentially have to borrow that money from, you know, most likely the Federal Reserve. They'll issue treasuries, and people will buy those, and the Federal Reserve will print money, and we end up having more debt. You know, and we pay $400 billion a year on that debt right now. And some people would say, well, that's a pretty good deal for having $17 trillion of debt and borrowing money every year. But it's not really that good of a deal, because when you borrow that money, they make it out of thin air. And then when you pay that money back, that money that you pay back is no longer thin air. That's real hard dollar cash that we have to pay for. And so he has voted for that budget. He's voted for previous budgets. One of the knocks on him was last October when Ted Cruz saw the writing on the wall. He knew the only way that we could deal with Obamacare was to defund it. And unfortunately, they kind of painted Ted Cruz into a corner, because he had been asking them to deal with it for quite some time at a more extensive, practical, and planned out means. But, you know, everybody, they had ignored it and ended up painted into a corner, and he had to stand his ground and filibuster so that they could try to defund Obamacare. And Adam Kinzinger was very harsh with Ted Cruz about his opposition to Obamacare and defunding it. Now, just as an aside, the U.S. House of Representatives had voted 37 times to repeal Obamacare. But my concern with that is that when you vote to repeal Obamacare and you don't have a legislative path to repeal, why are you going to vote to repeal Obamacare? So after the first or second time, maybe even after the fifth time, where it didn't get to, you know, where the Senate refused to listen to it, I think they would have started to say, okay, let's choose another strategy here. But they chose to go for the knockout punch 37 times. And I would think that, you know, in the rules of insanity would tell them, well, let's not try and do this over and over and over again, knowing that we're going to get the same result. Adam Kinzinger was in that, you know, in that part of the result, and he continued 37 times. We didn't have a public consensus to repeal Obamacare. Until we had a public consensus, there was no way that we were going to find a legislative path to victory. So they should have just said, okay, let's get the word out about Obamacare, because when they went through those repeal efforts, nobody really knew that much about Obamacare. There really wasn't a lot of information out there. There was a guy by the name of C. Stephen Tucker, who was the leader of the Chicago Tea Party. He was out there talking about it. He had delved into it. He knew all about it. But they weren't listening to Tucker. They were not listening to anybody but really themselves. And what they should have done was they should have taken the entire Obamacare bill and broken it up into, you know, sections, and given a section to each one of the Republican congressmen and said, read this, tell us what's wrong with it. We'll get back together in a couple of weeks, and we can start disseminating the information about what's wrong with it. But they never did that either, you know. So there was never any strategy on dealing with Obamacare. It was just kind of like, okay, it's there, so we're going to deal with it at some point in time. And he ended up refusing to sign on to defunding it at first. And he appeared at a meeting down in DeKalb, Illinois. And in DeKalb, it's part of the district. And one of the Tea Party leaders in DeKalb, Illinois, challenged him as to why he wouldn't defund Obamacare. His name was Ted McCarron. He asked him, "Why aren't you going to vote to defund Obamacare?" And he gave a shifty answer. And whether there was merit to defunding it or not, whether it would have passed or not in the Senate, the reality is they should have voted to defund it, and I believe they did vote to defund it, but then it was rejected by the Senate. They brought it back, and John Boehner was very angry and lashed out at the Tea Party, and so then they ended up passing it. But the reality is the only way to get rid of Obamacare, short of repealing it, is to defund it. And the House has the power to defund it, and they should have said we're not going to provide funds for it. Now, the question comes, will the president decide to shut the government down if we choose to defund it? And that's exactly what happened. They chose to defund it, and the president of the United States decided to shut the government down. It wasn't the Republicans that shut the government down. The Republicans just chose to defund Obamacare. It was the president of the United States that chose to shut down the government. So, and then, you know, this budget also that we had passed, Kinzinger had passed, it attacked veterans' benefits, took out $6 billion from their benefits and retirement pay. And they're the very one group that we shouldn't be attacking. They're the very one group of people who we have an absolute constitutional obligation to take care of, because they're the ones who have put their lives on the line for our country as a whole and, you know, face down foreign enemies. And then, you know, we have a Congress, in particular a Republican Congress, and Adam Kinzinger in particular, who's a veteran himself, who decides that veterans are disposable enough that we can go ahead and defund or cut their benefits and leave everybody else's benefits in place. You know, there's 70,000 people that work just for Homeland Security. The federal government is the largest employer in the world, and they couldn't find $6 billion to cut out of that federal budget. They had to go after veterans. That was very concerning to me. He's voted for a number of liberal spending programs. He just doesn't cut this bit, you know, cut the mustard when it comes to fiscal responsibility. He's always about the compromise. He's always about continuing to spend money. Now, he hasn't voted to raise taxes, but eventually at some point in time, because of all this spending, taxes will have to be increased.
Okay, bringing it back to Obamacare just a little bit, and as you mentioned, that the House voted about 37 times to repeal it, and you've been quoting saying that it's window dressing, a feel-good vote to make them look like they're heroes. They're not doing anything. Are you saying that perhaps that it's smoke and mirrors, and that the Republican House really has no true interest in ridding us of Obamacare, or would it be even more diabolical that some of them even support it?
Well, and here's kind of a test for that. After Obamacare went into effect and 5 million people lost their insurance and the entire nation was in an uproar over it, we at that point in time had not only a public mandate to be able to go through and repeal it, I believe we had a legislative path to victory. And here's a crowbar that you would use for that legislative path to victory. You could say to every Democrat senator who votes to not repeal it, you will be held accountable at the polls in November if you vote not to repeal Obamacare. I think that people were significantly affected enough, they were in enough pain over Obamacare, that they would have remembered at the polls every person, every senator who refused to repeal it. But what did they do? They didn't do that. You know, they have right now, they have a public mandate that they could use to repeal Obamacare. Right now, I believe they have a legislative path to victory, at least the chance of a legislative path to victory, or some sort of, you know, a punishment reward type situation where they don't vote to repeal it, you're going to get voted out of office. And if they do vote to repeal it, I believe they could even override a veto from the president. And if I'm wrong, guess what? We've got it all on the record. At least it's on the record. At least in the fall, we can use it to say, look, this senator from Louisiana or Missouri or New York or wherever decided, or, you know, Montana, decided that they didn't want to vote against it. They wanted to keep it in place. They wanted to keep it to punish you and to hurt your health care. And, you know, I think that they had a chance with that. Now, are they diabolical in that they want to keep it? I can't judge that. I don't know for sure. It's not something, you know, I'm not in their heads, but I do know that despite what we see, the drama that we see on TV, the big act that we see on TV, they think they're conservative.
Right.
Really, they're really not that conservative over there. So it's potential that they want to keep it in place, very, very well potential. And the other thing about Obamacare is that if that personal mandate or that business mandate goes into effect this fall, the American Enterprise Institute has come out with a study that says up to 80 million people could lose their health insurance.
Wow.
Okay, so 80 million people. That is staggering.
That's incredible.
That is pretty much everybody that's working. So
yeah,
I'm concerned about
it's a third of the country.
Yeah, so yeah, I mean, the concern about Obamacare is real, and we need to really have people who are going to go to Congress who are going to stand up and say, I'm not going to do this because I know it's going to hurt my constituents, or I am going to do this because I know it's going to help my constituents. And currently right now, we just don't have that. We don't have anybody with that kind of political courage, I guess, to be willing to take the body blows, short of, you know, a guy like Ted Cruz and Mike Lee and a couple of other real hard, you know, real hardcore patriot type guys who are and women who are in the Congress and the Senate. And certainly I just cannot put my opponent into that category of having any political courage right now. One of my other concerns, you know, he's got a commercial out that Lawrence O'Donnell is calling him a superhero. That's
right.
Running, yeah, I mean, you know, who puts a commercial out that, you know, where you approve a commercial that says that you're a superhero? Heroes don't go around calling themselves heroes. And
right.
if he wanted to really truly be a hero, he would have stood with Ted Cruz, and he would have fought against Obamacare the way Ted Cruz fought against Obamacare. You know, he's willing to go over to Iraq and Afghanistan and fly a big giant tanker to fuel up airplanes in the war effort, but he's not willing to lay it on the line here domestically in an effort to fight against the war on our health care.
Would you say that's where you feel that your opponent, Mr. Kinzinger, I'm the one having a hard time saying Kinzinger, but do you see where your opponent has failed, especially when it comes to failing the conservatives and conservative ideals?
I'm sorry, I don't know if I understood the question. Did you say, do I consider him a failure, or do I consider his political policies a failure?
No, do you feel that he has failed conservatives and conservative ideals?
You gotta be trying to fail, right? So you gotta be a conservative to fail. I wouldn't mind if he failed, you know, if he tried and failed, but he's not even trying. So I don't know if I would characterize it as failure so much as I would characterize it as negligence, maybe, magic, or a faux reality that he might be, you know, participating in order to be elected over and over again. So I don't know if it's failure. I don't think he as a human being is a failure. I think he as a human being is a highly successful person. In particular, he's a highly successful political animal in Washington, D.C. You know, he has a degree in political science. It's what he studied. It's what he wanted to be, was a politician. And he's very successful as a politician. He's not very good at being a representative of the values of this district in general. Now, he will fool people. I've heard him speak in person. And he talks a good talk. He talks the conservative talk when he's in with his constituents. But then when he gets to Washington, D.C., there's not a conservative bone in his body.
Got it. Okay, well, we'll switch gears just a little bit. And, you know, of course, I do some research before, you know, I interview folks on the show. And in that research, it appears our involvement in the Syrian war has had a strong effect on you. So if you could tell us why this is so, and why does it what does it tell you of the Obama administration and the direction this country is going, at least regarding our foreign policy?
Right. And just so you know, that wasn't just the Obama administration. My opponent was deeply entangled in that situation and invested in that situation. But, you know, obviously it was the commander-in-chief who tried to lay down policy when it came to military intervention in Syria. So let me just start a little bit from the beginning. I'll try to make it interesting and not too long. I apologize if it sounds long-winded, but...
Oh, no, that's okay. We've got plenty of time.
Cool. So what we have in Syria is his son, Assad, and he is a tyrant, okay? He's not a nice guy. Lots of bad stories about the guy and some of the things that he does to the people of Syria. But the reality is that he does... protect Christians of Syria. He has protected them at a macro level. Whether or not he's intervening in their lives in a personal way, in a personal selfish way, is another story, which is part of his monster kind of personality. And it's part of why the Syrian people decided they wanted to have a change in government. They wanted to have more freedom. And so about 3.5 years ago, they had an uprising, so to speak. It was a civil uprising, and they were demonstrating as part of the Arab, quote-unquote, Arab Spring, and they wanted to change the government. 3.5 years ago, Obama ignored it, and, you know, he didn't there was no engagement by him in that situation, just like there was no engagement by him when the Iranians did it. And we all criticized him for not engaging it, not necessarily militarily, but there could have been other means of engaging it on the ground. Oftentimes, you know, special forces will go into places and help to nation build, so to speak, or you know, teach people how to practice democracy. And I mean, there's just ways that we could have done it besides having a military intervention. And so the Syrian Free Army eventually... The Syrians ended up creating the Syrian Free Army, and the Syrian Free Army ended up in a kind of a protracted battle with the Assad military. Ended up that the Syrian Free Army, over the course of 3 years, essentially they were being all killed off. They had no real support. The Obama administration was not supporting the Syrian Free Army. They weren't sending arms or supplies to them, even humanitarian aid, and so it was easy for the Assad administration to start to kill them. Well, at the same time, simultaneous to all this happening, Libya was happening and Egypt was happening. There was a civil war in Libya and Egypt, and Obama was working behind the scenes to continue that and make that happen. He eventually intervened in Libya and had military forces intervene in Libya that ended in the death of Gaddafi. So after the end of this Libyan situation, all the fighters from Libya who felt like they had won their war, they needed a new fight. And they all are, they're all Sunni Muslims, part of the Muslim Brotherhood, and they're being supplied money by Saudis. And I'm not saying the Saudi government, but the Saudi people are a very wealthy people because of the oil wealth they have. They only have 17 million population. And they all get subsidies from the government and payments from the government, so they're able to take that money and funnel it to these fighters from Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood, which are one and the same. So they decided to start infiltrating up into Syria to make a fight there and to turn the tide. And the Syrian Free Army became overrun by Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood. Now what began to happen was Al-Qaeda began to kill and genocidally exterminate Christians in the north of Syria. They also infiltrated back over the border of Iraq into Fallujah and Ramadi, and we saw the result of that within the last few months, for which Adam Kinzinger wanted to go over and start bombing them over there again, as if the Iraqi military or the civil government of Iraq didn't have a say or or could not handle it. So ended up Kinzinger and Obama wanted to bomb Syria. And in bombing the Assad regime, what they would have done is they would have helped the al-Qaeda forces that had infiltrated into Syria. And they wanted to do it over the alleged use of chemical or biological weapons, sarin gas. I think those are chemical weapons. They wanted to, they wanted to intervene because they said that the Assad regime had dropped these sarin gas canisters on their own people and killed them. Well, it came out later that it was not the Assad regime, and Massachusetts Institute of Technology confirmed this with a big study that they did that said it was impossible for it to be the Assad regime that they would have done it. And it was really the al-Qaeda terrorists who had access to chemical weapons because a lot of the chemical weapons from Iraq that we didn't find had been transferred over the border to Syria, and they had proliferated throughout Syria. And they had not the federal, their government did not have control of all of those chemical weapons. And so al-Qaeda essentially dropped some bombs on their on the Syrian people, blamed it on the Syrian government, and Obama started talking about a red line in the sand, and my opponent decided to start carrying water for the Obama administration, wanting to go bomb the Syrian regime, and it would have ended up putting al-Qaeda in charge of Syria, just like they had gotten the Muslim Brotherhood and al-Qaeda had come to power in Egypt, and they control as much as controlled. They control Libya to a certain degree, and they would have controlled Syria. Now we would have had an al-Qaeda force on the border of Israel, and they would have been the controlling interest in the government if we would have gone in there, and would have left Israel absolutely vulnerable, which, to me that's just unacceptable. I'm not looking to have Israel have a war with Syria. And it would have happened because of those terrorists. And so I looked at it and said, wait a second. For 1,400 years, these folks have been killing each other in sectarian violence. The Sunnis and the Shiites control most of Syria. And that's why they have a connection to Iran, because Iran is Shiite. So they've been killing each other for about 1,400 years. The British tried to stop it. The Russians tried to change it. And we've tried to change it. And as soon as we leave, it goes right back to what it was doing. We've sent how many thousands and thousands and thousands of men and women back to the United States without arms, without legs? How many thousands have lost their lives, spilled their blood over that sand, which absolutely is precious to every one of us? And the job that they did was remarkable, and the blood that they spilled was important, and it is important. And nobody wants to see that ground given back to those people. But on the same token, I don't believe that another American child, I don't even say child or soldier, I don't want to see another American soldier who is somebody's mother, brother, sister, daughter, son, go over to the Middle East for really sectarian reasons of sectarian violence and have their lives wasted over something that's not going to change via the barrel of a gun. It's just not going to change. And I looked at it and I said, that's it. I cannot be represented by a man who's going to project values around the world that do not reflect the people of this district. The people of this district are not warmongers. They don't want to go out bombing everybody. And they certainly don't want to see our sons and daughters killed over 1,400 years of sectarian violence that's never going to change. Our military is not for the purpose of nation building. Our military is for the purpose of defending our government, our Constitution, and defending our borders. That's what our military is for. It's not, for foreign entanglements, as George Washington stated in his farewell speech when he left the presidency. And so this is why I was very adamantly opposed, and I'm not pro-war. So now I hate to say it like this, I guess I'm more anti-war than I am pro-war, but in reality, I'm not pro-war, and I'm only for war if we can prove a legitimate reason why we should go to war and expend the lives and the blood of our servicemen. And I love the military, and this is the point. I love the military. I don't have any desire to see them go and waste their lives for no good reason. And this is why I oppose the Syrian war, and this is why I oppose all war, unless we can prove that we have a legitimate, valid, constitutional reason for going to war. And that's
certainly,
it.
Now I'm going to take this question from the chat, and that is, says, what role can you play in protecting Christians in nations where they are persecuted?
Well, you know, there's not a big role we can take other than doing a couple of things. Number one, applying diplomatic pressure to these nations where they are persecuting Christians. Number two, providing them with the ability to protect themselves. So I believe, here's what I believe. The Second Amendment is the amendment that guarantees every other right that is protected in the Constitution. And I sometimes almost believe that the Second Amendment is the only thing that's restraining our current president. And I think that our Second Amendment should be proliferated throughout the world, and in particular in these nations where Christians are under heavy persecution from Muslim majorities. So if we had the Second Amendment proliferated in Syria, where the people were allowed to own firearms to protect themselves, I think you'd have a lot less persecution. You'd have a lot less Christians being beheaded in, you know, in places like Syria. But, you know, in Iraq, in a place like Iraq, Christians are almost completely wiped out of Iraq now. They've been eliminated or they've had to flee. Same with Iran. If you look at Egypt, what's happening over there, the Coptic Christians, they have faced a terrible persecution over there. It's estimated that Islam, since in the 1400 years of its existence, it's estimated to have killed 270 million people.
Wow.
That's a lot of people that are responsible for killing, you know. Much worse than anything the so-called Crusades ever did. So there's nothing militarily that I can say I'm willing to sign on to or agree to in order to go into these nations and protect Christians. I believe in self-sufficiency, and I believe that we should give these people the tools for protection, for self-protection. Other than that, we can apply diplomatic pressure. We can apply economic pressure to some of these nations. We probably should not be giving foreign aid to nations that are murdering Christians. In fact, we should probably, not just probably, we should not be giving foreign aid to nations that are murdering Christians.
Right. That was actually another one of the questions about defunding those countries. Now, in 2009, you were you founded a local Tea Party, and to my understanding, foreign policy and energy policy, because I do want to talk a little bit about energy policy, as I said, to my understanding, have not really been top priority issues for the Tea Party. Do you think there's a need for more attention to be paid to these issues? Why or why not?
No, not for the Tea Party. The Tea Party, the role, and well, let me just qualify that. I'm always willing, and I think we all should be willing, to evolve a little bit and to learn and be teachable. But the core responsibility or the core goal and mission of the Tea Party was to limit the size and scope of government and to make it more efficient and to limit taxation and to provide economic freedom for all Americans. Those were the stated goals of the Tea Party. I hate to get away from those stated goals because there are so many other organizations out there that deal with all the other issues. You know, there are pro-life organizations. There are foreign policy organizations, but I don't think there are foreign policy organizations. It ends up that a lot of the foreign policy organizations that are out there become neocons, and they're all ready to go out and bomb everybody, just like, you know, my opponent wants to do. And so would the Tea Party be a good venue for foreign policy statements? I don't know. It might be, but you'd have to have people who are very savvy with it. You'd have to have people who are very thoughtful about foreign policy. And it's just not been something that the Tea Party has focused on for these last 5 years. The Tea Party has focused on these domestic issues, and it would be very difficult to inject a foreign policy mission statement into the other mission statement that the Tea Party already has.
Okay, got it. Well, I appreciate you answering that, because I know, you know, as I said, founder of one of the Tea Parties. But we do, I do see that we are at quarter till the hour, and that's 45 minutes that went fast, and about 15 minutes we'll be going ahead and bringing in our contributors and any of our panelists that may be on the line. But for folks who'd like to chime in after they speak and maybe ask David any questions, you can do so at area code 347-945-7428. And for those of you out there listening either live or on the archives and you are a part of the Patriot Journalist Network, I just want to put out there that this Monday, March the 10th, between 7 and 9 p.m. Eastern Time, there will be a special live Red Meat event opposing Common Core. So check that out if you are a Patriot Journalist member by going to the website, and that is this Monday, March the 10th, from 7 to 9 p.m. Opposing Common Core. And so we'll move on to the a couple more questions before I bring our contributor Dan Gray in. And so tell us how your campaign is going, and what would you say is the most important resource that you need right now?
As far as resources, I'll talk about that in a minute. It's a catch-22 for me. But my campaign is my campaign is not a loud, bellicose campaign. It is essentially a social media campaign. It is a talking to the media campaign. So I've had a lot of articles done on my campaign throughout my district, and it's essentially a radio interview type campaign. So I don't have a lot of money in my campaign, and that's good and that's bad. It's kind of a catch-22 in that if I take money from PACs or super PACs, you know, subsequent to that, I'm going to be beholding to those, you know, PACs or super PACs. I'm going to have to listen to what they've got to say, and they're going to guide my policy. They're going to try to guide my policy decisions or choices. So, in a sense, it's good that I don't get money from these super PACs or these PACs, because now I can still retain my number one commitment to my constituents and retain my independence of these special interests who all have their own agendas. Now, it doesn't mean that I don't agree with some of them. You know, for example, the Heritage Action Institute, the Freedom Works, the Heritage Foundation, the Club for Growth, you know, I agree with much of what they say and do, but I'm a guy who doesn't like to have somebody try to manipulate me. I'm the guy who doesn't like it when somebody tries to force me into, you know, a corner, so to speak. I like my freedom a lot, and anybody that tries to force me to do something against my will, I'm going to push back against that. And so from that standpoint, it's good I'm not getting their money, but from the other standpoint, I'm not getting their money, which is causing me not to be able to get, you know, a campaign manager. I don't have a campaign manager. I've done my campaign all on my own. With a campaign manager, I would have gone to 100 times more speaking engagements than I've gone to, and I've gone to a lot of speaking engagements. With a campaign manager, I would have had somebody, you know, handling all my Federal Election Commission filings, and, you know, there are mm-hmm. things that a campaign manager can do for you. But you got to have money to pay a campaign manager.
Right.
So it's six of one, half dozen of another. And one of the answers to that is that, you know, we need to have significant amounts of campaign finance reform. We also need to have reform in the media for them to, you know, to be able to tell the truth. And one of the, you know, ways that we reform the media is having talk shows like yours that provide alternate sources of information. When you can't get the information from the sources you've gone to, you end up practicing democracy and capitalism, and you go to a different source. You know, it's kind of like if you don't like buying, you know, something, you know, from one car dealer and they provided terrible service, you go to another car dealer and you buy it there where they provide you better service. So it's the same way with the media. So it's a catch-22. The thing that I need the most in my campaign right now is publicity, getting other people to know about my campaign, and getting people to be motivated to go out to the polls and vote. And it's hard to motivate, you know, for lack of a better term, it's hard to motivate a lazy boy society. A lot of people have, you know, the way I want to say this is a lot of people have given up. And because they've given up, because of how bad our politics are, they resign themselves to their living rooms and those lazy boys, where it's not as painful as it is when you're dealing with politics. And it's a painful experience having to deal with the nasty grunge of the political life. And, you know, people are not seekers of pain. They don't, you know, they don't like suffering. They don't like pain. And so a lot of them just end up saying, okay, you know, I'm done. And I've talked to so many people like that. They just say, I don't want to deal with politics. I hate it. And you know what? I'd rather be watching Dancing with the Stars too myself. You know, it's a great show, you know.
For Survivor, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, or, you know, Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, or, you know, the bizarre foods.
Right. No, and there's a couple other shows I can't even remember what they were that I used to used to watch.
Pawn Stars.
Pawn Stars. Yeah, I've heard of that one. And we only got about 8 minutes. Before I bring them on, so I want to get a couple of these last questions out. And how important do you think it is for the 2016 presidential election for there to not only be only Republicans in the House and Senate, but conservative Republicans? What impact do you think this can have on that race?
Well, I don't know what my race can impact, how that my race can impact them. I don't think we're in danger of losing the House. So anything that we can gain is all window dressing for us. You know, it's icing on the cake. So I don't think we'll lose the House, but this is one of the flaws with the Republicans and my opponent right now, in that they keep on counting on the idea, well, once we get the Senate, if we can just get the Senate, if we can just get the presidency, then we can go and we can change everything. But you know what? That's not there's no guarantees in this life that we're going to get the Senate or the presidency. And so, you know, delaying dealing with the flaw, the problems in our government until we get the Senate and the presidency is a pipe dream. We need to start dealing with it now and start going to bat for it now. Will we get the Senate and the presidency? I don't know. It depends on how much we can inflict political pain on Hillary Clinton's campaign and reveal the truth about who she is. You know, it depends on how the Republicans deal with Obamacare over the next 6 months as to whether or not they'll have a true issue to go to the polls with to defeat the Democrats. You know, Dick Durbin, we've got Dick Durbin on video saying the exact same thing that President Obama said. If you want your health care, if you want to keep your health care plan, you can keep it. If you want your doctor, you can keep it. He said it on the Senate floor. So we can beat them. It just takes people in Congress and the strategizers to step up and say, okay, let's beat them. And they're just not, I just don't believe they're doing that.
Okay, and no, I've got a chance to look at your website, which is quite impressive. I mean, there's all kinds of information and links to information there. It's rather impressive, and I've seen a number of I won't mention any names, of course, but I've seen a number of candidates' websites just through the interview process and the interviewing candidates. Yours is, I have to say, one of the better websites that I've seen.
Thanks.
So can you just tell the audience a little bit more of what they can find there and provide us with the link?
Oh, yeah, electdavidhale.com. It has a blog that my webmaster put up there that when I have something I need to communicate to a mass audience, I put it out on that blog, and there's a link directly on there that you click that, it'll take you to the latest issue in my blog. It also contains a donation button. It also contains my positions on a number of the issues. It also contains some links to some press and some links to some of the organizations that I truly believe in and support, like the Cato Institute and their whole regimen or plan for downsizing the federal government. And it is an impressive plan. So there's a lot of good links out there, and I hope people will go out there and look at those things. And it's not a website that is meant to direct people to how to be more dependent on government. It's a website that's meant to direct people on how to deal with the issues that our government currently is inflicting on us now.
Okay, great. And definitely check that out, folks. And if you could give them the name of the link again, that'd be great.
ElectDavidHale.com. That's ElectDavidHale.com.
Great. And then last question before I bring our contributor Gray on. Are there any other topics or issues, just for the next about 4 minutes before we get to the top of the hour, that we have not touched upon that we'd like to discuss?
Oh, man. I have to look at my blog, I guess. No, I think one of the things that I would like to see done is, you know, they talk about repeal and replace Obamacare. I don't necessarily agree with the replace part of Obamacare, but what I do believe in is a level of reform that could have taken place with a consensus and the advisement of a number of groups to reform some elements of our healthcare system, which, yeah, there were some flaws and there were some cracks where people fell through those cracks. But our healthcare system worked pretty darn good until Obamacare came along, and we just needed a couple of tweaks on our healthcare system. One of them I would like to have seen would have been health savings accounts expanded so that they last a lifetime instead of getting erased after a year or two. And in addition to having your HSAs, I'm sorry, I just got distracted for a second, having your HSAs being able to be passed on to your children. So if you could have your HSAs passed on to your children or to your spouse if you pass away, but only for the specific intent purpose of it going into their HSAs, now you end up rolling money over that you've earned all your life. You get to roll that money over into your children's accounts, and now they have their own HSAs, and it just balloons. And down the line, folks end up having these piles of money in these HSAs, and they could pay for everything. They could pay for their health. They could pay for their CT scan. They could pay for their MRI. They could pay for their cancer treatments, if they've got the money in their health savings accounts. And, of course, when the health savings accounts would first start off, there would need to be some sort of a supplemental insurance, and that's why insurance should still be available for everybody. And then I think that there's a way to deal with providing care for the poor. We have a clinic up here in Rockford called the Crusader Clinic, very successful at providing care to the poor. I think these Crusader-type clinics could be brought out, and low-income people could be cared for at Crusader-type clinics. And then I also believe that we needed to reform how immediate care clinics interact with people. If you're sick, if you're really sick, and you can't get to your doctor on a weekend, but you're not deathly sick, like you're not having a heart attack, you can go to an immediate care clinic, spend $100, have the doctor look at you, get a diagnosis, and walk out of there maybe with some medications, or maybe with a referral to something on Monday for $100. Well, maybe we can block grant money to some of these MediCare clinics and require people to pay copays to go to these MediCare clinics, and they would be able to see people that might not have a doctor or might not have insurance. So there are some ideas. And then the one other thing was the reform of the EMTALA laws. The EMTALA laws are the Emergency Medical and Treatment Act. And as an emergency room nurse myself, I had to deal with the EMTALA laws a lot. So anybody that comes into your triage area, you have got to, you're required by law to take care of that person, and they have to be seen by a doctor or a representative of the doctor, like a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant. And so that costs hospitals a lot of money when they, for lack of a better term, when illegally present foreign nationals come in, and they come in with, their five kids, and trust me, as a nurse, I've seen this, I've experienced this, I've dealt with this, and they come in with their five children, and sweet little children, sweet kids, they're kids, and, they got the sniffles, kids get the sniffles. But they come in and they have to be seen by a doctor. It takes away resources from people who are truly dying and in the worst situations in their lives, having strokes, having heart attacks, massive traumas and car accidents. And the doctor has to take care of these, the 1, 2, 3, or 5, however many kids that come in who, they're sick, but they can wait to go to, maybe an immediate care clinic on Monday. So the EMTALA laws need to be reformed so that the truly sick can be taken care of and the truly unsick can still be taken care of but not be required to be taken care of by an emergency room that then has to subsequently foot the bill that comes about from having to take care of all the kids or all the illegally present foreign nationals or all the folks who didn't have insurance. And I can tell you a story here real quick. I know I only have less than 40 seconds left.
That's okay. We got plenty of time, Phil. Go ahead.
I've seen illegally present foreign nationals come into my emergency room. They pull out their matricular ID card. We have to accept it. They go back out to the waiting room, and they take the matricular ID card and hand it off to the next person, to another person that would come in, and then that person would come with the same ID card, same name, and I'd have to put it in. I had no choice.
Ugh, that's ridiculous.
It's terrible. So that needs to be reformed. Those EMTALA laws need to be reformed. And then the last point is on the issue of healthcare is the way that illegally present foreign nationals are able to get into our healthcare system is two ways. Number one, we have less than honorable people working in many of the social service agencies that look the other way when they come in, and they'll sign them up for welfare in our welfare office. And we also have birthright citizenship. And so when an illegally present foreign national comes across the border or flies in from another country, has a baby on our territory, child becomes a citizen, and now that parent can stay in the country indefinitely. And now the baby is the means of obtaining welfare and health care through the entire system.
Yeah, that drives me absolutely insane. I think we should say we need to just get rid of that completely, in my opinion. My opinion, that needs to go away. But at this time, and thank you very much, we will be bringing in our contributor here, Dan Gray. Thank you very much, Dan, for holding on. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. A little tired. Holding on, are you kidding? David Hale, I have to say this, you're a very impressive fella. I'm looking at your website as well. And before I ask you any questions, I just want to say that that servant's heart that you're talking about, the service that you've decided to give in your life in the armed forces and as a trauma nurse, that's very meaningful, and it would be really nice to, I also assume you're not a millionaire like most of the people who are in representatives in Washington at this moment. That's a good thing. Listen, to start with,
thank
kind
thank
of
you. Thank you for the kind words. I do appreciate those. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. To start with something that's rather than all the issues that we've been dealing with, just an informational piece. So you're in the 16th District on the east end of the northeast corner of Illinois. And the east end of your district abuts Chicago and the suburbs. You're nestled next to Iowa and Wisconsin. Now, I have a fair idea.
I'm sorry. Let me interrupt you
Go
there.
Ahead.
That's the old district.
What's the new one look like?
Yeah, my district runs in the old district. Rockford was the seat of the district. It was the focus of the district. Now the district runs from the Wisconsin border in South Beloit, Rock and Roscoe.
Okay.
Down through about half of Rockford, which is a very zigzag line through Rockford, which is gerrymandered for the 17th Congressional District. And it comes down to LaSalle Peru, and it continues south of LaSalle Peru for about a half hour. And
wow.
Then it cuts to the east, and it goes through Pontiac, Grundy County, Morris, Illinois, and then all the way over into Iroquois County, which is on the Indiana border. And so it cuts under the suburbs of Chicago, and it cuts right south of Joliet and over to the border, and then down south of that is the southern end of the district, which is just a little north of Champaign, Urbana, about probably, I would say, 30 minutes north of Champaign, Urbana.
Somebody's going to have to update that Wikipedia page, I'll tell you what. you've got an interesting demographic there. I mean, that's a real mix of rural and small towns and some not-so-small towns. Tell our listeners about the demographics and the character of the people in this gerrymandered district. And what sort of folks do you have working and living there?
Yeah, it is a very diverse district. The uniqueness about it is that it's not Chicago, because Chicago has its own districts, highly urbanized, very limited farming areas, whereas Rockford has a strong urban environment, a strong blue-collar environment, and then you also have the strong farming environment, and in a strong union environment. So it's farmers, union members, manufacturing, white-collar workers, blue-collar workers. It's got the entire mix. And those kind of mixes exist everywhere. But we have more of a concentration of these, or a more equitable distribution of these throughout this district because of where we're at. Whereas if you go toward Chicago, you might get 5% farmers and 50% unions, and then 40% urbanites. Whereas here, it's much more evenly distributed. So it's an interesting district, one of the most interesting districts in the country.
Now, it sounds a lot like some parts of Pennsylvania, to be honest. Now, you mentioned in the beginning of your program that video that you took. I watched that. Got that up on my Facebook page. At Shades of O'Keefe there, really nice to expose by just asking a question, what are you doing here? Why are you doing your job right now? That was really nice.
It was a shade of O'Keefe, and I'll tell you what, Ed O'Keefe is an incredible guy.
I met him last year.
Yeah,
he's very entertaining and not over the top at all. The whole reason he's doing his thing in this outrageous way is because he's trying to expose hypocrisy, and quite frankly, you got to go at them in the best way possible, which is to show people that they're really not telling the truth. They're not living according to their precepts, and then they're going to hold you as a Tea Party candidate, as a conservative candidate, to a higher standard. You're supposed to live up to, and you should live up to, the things that you say you believe in. But we're not allowed to do it to them, so he does it with humor. Now, about the right to work, you're in Illinois. You're in the belly of the beast. Now, here in Pennsylvania, we've got a Republican governor, a Republican legislature, a Republican Senate, and we've had no right to work legislation at all until lately. Finally, they have two bills, Paycheck Protection, I don't know what they're doing in Illinois with this, but it ends the practice of the state paying to deduct dues and fees from government workers who are forced to pay these progressives in the union. And I'm pro-union guy. I just don't like the progressives. It's a condition of employment. If you want to work for the government, you are in the union. And the other is a criminal law change. I don't know if you'll believe this, but then again, you're not that far from Chicago. Here in Pennsylvania, currently, under current law, harassment, stalking, terroristic threats, they're protected behavior if the perpetrators are union. What's the law look like in Illinois for these things?
Well, I'll tell you an interesting story. We had a case up here in Rockford where a guy was caught stealing copper wire from a city building. And come to find out, he worked for the city, worked for our public works department. He was a union member. And they couldn't fire him. It was a first offense. And so because it was a first offense and he had stole thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars of copper wire. And
even though it was a criminal offense.
It was a criminal offense.
Yeah.
Stripped it out of these buildings, caused a lot of damage. He couldn't be fired because he was a union member. So it happens here too, you know. It happens. Those kind of situations, unions are able to control and manipulate, and the law doesn't matter sometimes with unions.
So. Well, it does depend on who's in the prosecutor's office to a large extent. Now, you mentioned in hospitals where you have a lot of experience that you'll see people from social service programs, the welfare department, for instance, actually signing people up knowing that they're not supposed to sign them up. Here in Pennsylvania, for welfare and unemployment, I work in unemployment as a claims examiner in my day job, we use the Department of Homeland Security's SAVE system, which I don't know why they're not using this nationwide. It literally takes our trained workers 10, 15 seconds to verify information, and it's not just a name. It's an ID that we have to get a clear photocopy of, and we compare it online on the, it's a very secure system, unlike most of the government stuff, to a picture. So if the pictures don't match, pictures of faces, if every detail on those cards don't match, the person is denied benefits because it's only for citizens. Doesn't Illinois use anything like that?
Well, two things about that. Within the hospitals, that those social workers are different from the social workers, the social services workers mm-hmm. that you'll see in government employ. The social workers that you see in hospitals are an amazing clinical group of people with skills that are just phenomenal at dealing with the social problems that people have. And so they don't do those kind of things. Those kind of things are done by social service workers, which I want to make that distinction between a social worker, especially one in a hospital, and a social service worker who may not even be trained in some of the things that a social worker is trained in. So the social services workers are just people that work at social services, you know. And in particular, it's these illegally present foreign nationals that are getting these welfare benefits. So you can trace, Jim Smith, you can trace that person fair enough, easy enough, let me see your driver's license, when it comes to some of the illegals, you can't trace them, especially when they present with a matricular ID. And when they're able to present with a matricular ID, which is issued by supposedly the Mexican consulate, there's no record within our system of these matricular IDs. But the problem is with the social services workers who may not be ethically motivated but are more liberally motivated. And so part of their worldview is, well, we need to provide welfare for this person because, they might feel sorry for that person, so they want to provide welfare at the expense of the system.
Well, it's at the expense of whoever actually pays taxes because they have a job. and our grandkids yet unborn who have to pay for this stuff, even though they're not
mm-hmm.
here to earn money yet. Listen, bringing that into just touching on immigration, because you...
But real quick...
go ahead.
Sorry about that, Dan. But real quick, I just want to give out the call-in number again for those that would like to chime in or to just listen in here on the line. You can call in at 347-945-7428. Again, it's 347-945-7428. Go ahead, Dan. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I wanted to get into some of the things about healthcare because of your particular experience working directly, hands-on in that field. But in terms of immigration, I guess I would have to assume that you would not go along with Speaker Boehner or Mitch McConnell's plans, the RINO's plans, to basically grant amnesty to this so-called 11 million figure of illegals here, which hasn't changed since right after Reagan got conned into giving amnesty the first time. Am I right that you are not in favor of that, or do you have a different view? Or
well, I'm not in favor of it, absolutely not, and I certainly do have a different view of how immigration should be dealt with in America. Number one, you know, the Senate amnesty plan, I've got a whole list of things that the Senate amnesty plan does and does not do. But one of the things it does not do is enforce the current immigration laws. And one
it doesn't close the border either.
Yeah, it doesn't close the border. And it does ultimately give amnesty to illegals without regard to whether or not they're going through the immigration process. And so I don't want to go too deep into all the nitty-gritty of it. But it, suffice it to say, you can go to Numbers USA, and you can find exactly what the Senate amnesty plan does. And one of the things that I would say about the immigration issue is, you know, the president right now is having a trust issue. A lot of people don't trust him, and a lot of conservatives in Congress don't trust him to do what he says he's going to do. And so they want to send down this plan with the security, and they want the border security to be applied or deployed simultaneous to the rest of the plan that they're proposing. Well, a lot of us don't believe that they'll ever get to the border security if they pass it. So what I would say, if the president wants to participate in bipartisanship and compromise, like he expects everybody else to do, and if the Democrats want to participate in the same like they expect everybody else to do, why don't they go ahead and pass a border security bill first?
Well, actually, why don't they just enforce the existing laws to begin with? The Border Patrol Agents Union is vehement in their assertions, which they have proven not only with sworn testimony but with videotape, that they're being told to stand down. They are not permitted to do their jobs under existing law.
And so what they could do is they did pass a border security fence bill, but it's wrapped up in red tape. So if the president wants to show good faith, well, let's go ahead and build that fence. Let's watch it work for a year. And then after we've got it working, then let's start doing the immigration bill. And let's take the immigration policies out of the hands of Congress exclusively, and let's have discussions with the American people, whether it be in meetings, town halls, whatever it might happen to be. Let's have discussions with the American people as to what we should do and how we should enact the policy. But what we end up getting is special interest groups.
The Chamber of Commerce represents the largest organizations in business in this country who are predominantly in favor of illegals because it keeps workers insecure. As Alan Greenspan once said, that's great for large corporations because they're less likely to make trouble. But we've got all these people who are unemployed, and they want to keep bringing in people who are willing to work for a lot less. I don't see how that helps. Listen, if we could switch gears, you mentioned some interesting things on Obamacare, the health savings accounts, the EMTA laws. There are some other things regarding Obamacare I want to ask, but with those EMTA laws and the idea of these crusader clinics, wouldn't it still require, you're in emergency rooms, that there'd be triage and some testing of whoever comes in, because you can't turn somebody away who's sick just because they're not bleeding all over the floor. I mean, how would you deal with that from a practical point of view?
Yeah, so Crusader Clinic, the Crusader Clinic is not a on-the-spot immediate care clinic. The Crusader Clinic is a place where you get to have a doctor, basically, and that doctor either is volunteering at that Crusader Clinic or they're being paid a very minimal amount via...
So this is private, not government?
No, it is, to a certain degree, it is government, because there's a lot of things that go into a clinic like that that have to be taken care of. You need supplies, you need personnel to work. So there's some government intervention or interaction with it. But you put them on strict budgets, and medical people are very good at restricting their budget. So it would be a Crusader Clinic that people that are poor could go there and they could have a doctor. So I'll call the Crusader Clinic today because I need an appointment to go see the doctor on Friday. You set your appointment up and you go down and you see the doctor. So they're different from immediate care clinics. Immediate care clinics are places where, you know, man, I'm throwing up, I need to go see the doctor, or, you know, I've got a bad headache or bad head cold, I need to go see the doctor. And I stop down at the immediate care clinic and spend $100, and the doctor gives you an evaluation. If he feels like you need to be, or he or she feels like you need to be seen in an emergency room, then they refer you on to an emergency room. Or I've seen where the doctor had an EKG done in an immediate care clinic, and they called an ambulance and had that person transported to the ED.
So, in other words, it leaves the choice of how sick a person feels they are to that person. I know myself that there are times where I'm really sick and I just need a little rest, or I'm really sick and I need some over-the-counter medicine, or, heck, I'm still going to make it to work and just wait for the weekend. That's a good idea. Listen, there are some points on Obamacare reforms. You said individual reforms rather than remaking an entire system. Pre-existing conditions is the one that touches most people's hearts, because we know people who get sick and stay sick or have a long-term condition. Healthcare portability. My car insurance is not just sold in Pennsylvania. I won't mention the name of the company. However, they're nationwide, not nationwide, but they are across the nation. And it gives an economy of scale, which permits me to buy really adequate coverage. It's good for my vehicles, but doesn't cost me as much as healthcare does for the same type of coverage. There's tort reform, which really, really gets the progressives, because they don't want to lose the money from the lawyers' associations.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think on those issues? Pre-existing conditions, healthcare portability across state lines, and tort reform.
Yeah. So let me just answer the last two first. Portability, absolutely. Great idea. Tort reform, absolutely need tort reform. We need to protect people, but we also need to protect, doctors. In the state of Illinois, and I'll get to the first question in a second, but the state of Illinois right now, you can't find a brain surgeon above I-80, okay? So I-80 is a highway that runs basically across the country, and it cuts through the upper third of Illinois. You cannot find a brain surgeon north of I-80. We almost lost most of our OBGYNs.
Yeah, same here in Pennsylvania. Exactly.
Yeah, because of malpractice insurance being so out of control in the state of Illinois, because they're so liberal with the torts here. So we got to have tort reform. Don't get in an accident above I-80 in the state of Illinois involving a head trauma. You're going to have some serious problems.
Wow.
And for the first one, tell me the first one again. Pre-existing, right. So pre-existing conditions are an interesting animal. Under the current law, you cannot be turned down for a pre-existing condition. So today I could break my leg, okay? and I know my leg is broken, so let's pretend it's 10 o'clock in the morning. I know my leg is broken. I can call an insurance company. I can sign up for insurance, and I can go down to the emergency room and have my leg, taken care of. And then after it's done and taken care of and all the bills are paid, I can drop my insurance if I want to. And then, it happens again, I can do it again. So the whole thing about pre-existing conditions was essentially this. If you worked for a company and you had insurance with that company and you decide to move from company, Acme Industrial Works over to, ABC Mechanical, okay, and you have insurance, you can move seamlessly, even if you have a pre-existing condition. That was the law prior to the Obamacare law.
Mm-hmm.
Now the law is, under any circumstance, if you have a pre-existing condition, you can call an insurance company, they have to give you insurance, period. They cannot reject you from getting insurance. So how we could have handled this is the issues, the methods that I mentioned in the previous segment, previous to you coming on,
was
if you are part of one of those programs, so you belong to a Crusader clinic, or you go to a Crusader clinic for your hospital care, or you go to a MediCare for your hospital care, and you've been paying, you're in some sort of a program or some sort of a general situation where you're working or being seen by somebody on a regular basis, or you had insurance or whatever, you should be able to qualify for insurance even if you have a pre-existing condition, because essentially it's being documented. I don't feel that it's right that you should be able to qualify for a pre-existing condition when it's not been documented anywhere and you're just gaming the system. However, here's the concern with that. If a person is sick and they can't get taken care of, they can't get their broken leg fixed or seen to after they go leave the emergency room, we have to have a way to take care of those people somehow. And I think this is where people have fallen through the cracks. And this is where we might need to find a way to, I hate to say subsidize because I'm so just adamantly opposed to subsidization. But we need to find a way to not let those people fall through the cracks if they didn't have insurance and they come down with cancer, okay? But you're a young person, you didn't have insurance, and you're 31 years old, and you're on top of the world as a 31-year-old female, and you're very healthy, and then all of a sudden you have breast cancer.
Well, I'll tell you what, back in the I'm a bit older than you, I think. I'll be 54 shortly. And I was paying attention when I was a little kid. We used to have charity hospitals and county hospitals. Now, the county hospitals and the city hospitals were run by the government, and people avoided those like the plague. Unless you were unconscious when the ambulance was taking you somewhere, you wouldn't allow yourself to go there. However, the charity hospitals, where people voluntarily gave their own money, which we do today, where Americans are the biggest volunteers and donators to good causes of all kinds that we believe in, they gave great care. Some of them were religious-based organizations, the Jewish hospitals and Catholic hospitals. Some were based on, specific illnesses and ailments. And a lot of them were just really, really decent. And they gave good care because the people who supported them, the people who worked there, the people who were part of their system, did it because they cared. Nobody really made a lot of money in healthcare in those days. Even doctors
and that was one of. And that is one of the ideas that I've had is not necessarily charity hospitals, but a way to have organizations out there that are not taking all the money and paying for salaries, but rather receiving money from individuals because they truly care, that then they subsequently turn that money around and provide medical care, or having a charity hospital where medical professionals can volunteer. And I'll tell you right now, flat out 100%, I would, if I had the opportunity to volunteer as a clinical nurse in an emergency room, I would do it. I would pull a shift or two, maybe three or four every month as a volunteer, not getting paid. But we don't have that option. We don't have that opportunity anymore.
most of the healthcare workers and decent folks I know in all kinds of fields are willing to volunteer, and they do. But as you said, in any kind of field where there's certification and over regulation, that's not just the medical field, you're not permitted to do anything except under the strict aegis and control of a controlling organization. One of the healthcare issues that's, in fact, it's first on your website, I am pro-life, before even Second Amendment, and that mirrors my particular views myself. Kinzinger says he's pro-life and has endorsements from pro-life groups. One of the things I've noticed is that certain conservatives and certain liberals are rhinos or progressives, and they will use splinter techniques, like Alinsky over in Chicago came up with, where they will support an aspect, just one aspect or two, of something that touches our hearts, like pro-life.
Yep.
And
yep.
yet, when it comes to everything else, and Lindsey Graham comes to mind. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
When it comes to everything else, they're a complete failure, and they won't adhere to constitutional principles. Now, Kinzinger, do you think that his views on pro-life, obviously they mirror yours, are authentic? Do you think he believes this? I don't know.
I think he's authentic on life. I do, but I do have to question that he refuses to sign on to the Life at Conception Act, whereas he promised to sign on to the Life at Conception Act. He has refused to sign on to it.
That's the key right there, isn't it? That's the key to all of it, because if it's life, it's protected, that baby, that child is protected just as you and I are, or at least we're supposed to be, by the Bill of Rights, which says you can't kill us without due process.
Well, and I think being a pro-lifer, you need to be active in it. And so what I mean by being active as a legislator, one of the ways you can be active is proposing legislation that actually deals with the issue of life. He has proposed nothing, but I have proposals for the issue of life that I would bring to Congress to deal with the issue of life. And one of them is to require all abortion clinics across the country to meet the same standards of operation as same-day surgery centers. And in meeting those same standards of operation as a same-day surgery center, it would cause those abortion clinics to be able to have to charge an awful lot of money for an abortion. And people, you make something cost more money and they're not going to do it. But we've made abortion so accessible and so cheap that they can do it. But we had a case here in Rockford where the local abortion clinic, there was a lot of controversy over it. Pro-life folks would go there and protest, and I even went over and protested a few times with them. They'd go over there and pray, and they were very peaceful. But the folks that owned the abortion clinic were very vicious and mean-spirited and assaulted them and everything. Well, come to find out, the Illinois Department of Public Health had not visited the clinic for years and years, and they finally went in and paid a visit. They went in and paid a visit, and guess what happened? They immediately, on the spot, shut them down because of the health code violations that took place in that abortion clinic.
And well, that happened nearby. I work in Allentown. It's about 45 miles from where I live in Pennsylvania. Go ahead.
Again, real quick. I just we'll have you finish your point, but right after that, I do want to bring our panelist Cindy Todd in. We have her on
good.
The line. So go ahead, finish your point, and then we'll bring in Cindy. For any of the other folks who are new listening in, you'd like to chime in, or we only have about 26 minutes of live time left here on the show. But we do have available to us the extended version, which we go into most times on the show. But if you don't call in at 347-945-7428, you will not be able to hear the extended version. Of course, you would be able to hear it on the archive, which would be available very shortly after the show ends, but you would not be able to listen to it live nor be able to chime in and join our roundtable discussion unless you call within the next 26 minutes at 347-945-7428. So call just to listen in, or if you'd like to chime in, that'd be great as well. So thank you very much there, Dan. Go ahead, and then after that we'll bring in Cindy. Go ahead.
Sure. You know, this would be a heck of a lot easier if I could see you giving frantically waving your hands and giving cues. I work in Allentown, about 45 miles away from where I live in Pennsylvania, and they just had exactly the same experience. They finally inspected an abortion clinic, and it was so filthy they shut it down. Filthy and unhealthy, and just a place where you wouldn't go to have, you know, if you cut your foot, you wouldn't want stitches. And we're not that far from Philadelphia. I'm sure all of our listeners are aware of the Gosnell House of Horrors, supported by progressive politicians. No inspections for 16 years. I won't even mention, if any of you have the strong stomach and are willing to cry your eyes out and ache for days, just look, put Gosnell in on the computer and look at the testimony that came out in trial. He's been sentenced to life in prison for his murder of these. I mean, it was so bad that even people who say that they're pro-choice, they couldn't fathom it either. Anyway, I want to hear from Cindy.
Okay, great. Well, then we'll open up your mic there, Cindy. Thank you very much for calling to the show. How are you?
Okay, did I unmute myself this time?
You have unmuted yourself.
Okay, that's cool. That's really cool. Hey, glad to have you on. And I just wish the very best for you. I really hope that you can get some traction and win there in your state.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming on. You've done a great job. You got me convinced. Too bad I don't live in Illinois, but.
Thanks. Yeah, I wish.
Well, listen, I just helped put in our we have a freshman congressman up there in Washington. His name's Ron DeSantis, and he's really been pleasing me. I think he's done just about exactly what I would expect him to do and what I wanted him to do. And in fact, what most of us here in this county wanted him to do. We have I thankfully live in a pretty conservative Republican county. We many times go Democrat in certain elections, but the Republicans who do vote here are not the RINO types. In fact, we kind of cleared our REC out of them, and we're able to get people in like Ron DeSantis and some other conservatives in our county council and things like that. But anyway, Ron co-authored the 28th Amendment, which, you know, hasn't gone anywhere yet, but certainly hundreds of thousands of people have seen it and would love to have it pass. You know what that is, don't you?
Yeah, 28th Amendment, I believe it deals with term limits, right?
No, it's that Congress has to live under the same laws that they create.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay, yeah, now I know about it, yeah. No, I definitely agree. I definitely agree with that.
Well, you know, that law, you know, a lot of people go around, you know, all the liberal truth things like Snopes and Urban Legends and all that, they go around saying, well, there's really nothing in that. The Congressional Accountability Act of 1995 takes care of that, and Congress has to live under the same rules as we do and all that. But that is just strictly poppycock, because there are many, many things that Congress does not have to do that we all have to do, including buying their health care coverage. Even though they sort of have to buy it, they get subsidies for it, so they don't have to pay for it.
Well, that was Obama giving unconstitutional waivers.
Exactly, and that's what happens. Congress ends up getting all kinds of unconstitutional waivers. But anyway, I'm just wondering, Ron sort of picked up a pet peeve of his and ran with it. Is there any pet peeve that you have that you'd like to write some legislation I mean, like the minute you get in there, you'd sure like to work on it.
Yeah.
What would that be?
Oh, wow. Well, that's a good question because there's so much that it's hard for me to define exactly which one I would like to deal with right away. So legislatively, I think one of the first things I would like to do is get this requirement for abortion clinics to abide by the same rules as same-day surgery centers. I think that would be one of my first. I'd also like to immediately go to work on dealing with the Obamacare issue and applying some of my ideas to the Republicans' plan that they're currently trying to, posit. I'd like to apply some of the ideas, at least get those ideas in front of some committees and review those committees and have some hearings on some of those ideas. It would probably be those two issues. Of course, there are other issues dealing with the debt. Term limits is something I would just love to mm-hmm. see put out there, but I think that there are some bills out there for term limits. It just requires that you sign on to those because they already exist. I'd also like to work on repealing the current income tax and closing the IRS as an agency. That would be a little bit bigger of a task, a job, and something that you wouldn't be able to just throw into a committee real quick. But closing the IRS would be one of my dream kind of pieces of legislation that
every listener is applauding you right this second.
Yeah. Yes, everyone is. Well, you could be getting some traction with that. I mean, the fair tax people are really gaining ground, and they're really gaining some traction. So you might be getting some help with that if you get in.
Yep.
In the near future.
And I support the concept of the fair tax. I've read the fair tax books. I understand how it works completely. I just don't agree with the 23%.
Yeah, me too. That's my problem with it.
Yeah, I would support a probably more like a 15% tax rate and then require we close a number of government agencies to make up for the shortfall.
Yeah.
But I do not support a 23% national sales tax. It's out of control.
Well, I have to say I'm very glad to hear about your strong stand against abortion and how abortion clinics are run. I really appreciate that because these days that issue really gets squelched a lot. People don't want to talk about it because when you raise it, it's a controversy. It's, it's something that people, even in the...
Well, When you raise that issue, that issue becomes, you're engaging in the war on women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, 97% of all abortions take place for elective reasons. And, I love women and I care about women. My mother is a woman. And so I'm not engaging in a war on women. I'm engaging in a advocacy, children who truly do feel pain when they go through these abortions.
Yes.
But more than that, the life that is snuffed out through an elective process, whereas if people would just be a little bit more responsible with how they interact with one another, that life would never have been put into the situation to have been snuffed out in the first place. So
not only that, but the
moral decision.
Yeah, the women who have abortions are uniformly devastated. It's a horrible thing to interrupt the mothering process. It's bad enough to have a miscarriage. It's bad enough to have a horrible situation like your son having cancer. When you have a child, you care. And then to willfully, casually throw a life away, if you have any conscience at all, it will eat at you. And I'm not saying those women are bad, it's a bad choice.
And that's the important thing about this is that this is not about condemning women. This is you know, it's really about protecting women and protecting the baby and protecting our consciences. We, you know, the reality is that there are studies done on how women have had, you know, devastating, you know, consequences from it. And just a little aside, my son actually did not have cancer. It was a non-malignant tumor. Tumor was removed. And
I'm not a medical guy, but okay.
Oh, well, that's okay. But my son was, you know, the tumor was removed. And, in fact, just before I came on the show, I was at my son's first high school play tonight.
Oh, that's awesome.
And
oh, wow.
One of the main characters in the play, and it was fun to watch my 15-year-old son up there in the play. So.
And Robert's daughter's a little younger, and she's also interested in theatrics.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes, she is.
Yeah, so I think abortion would be one of the issues I'd want to deal with, but I totally understand the plight that women go through, the terror that they feel when they've come into a situation that they don't necessarily want to happen. But I think that we have to help people overcome that fear and overcome the stigma of it to understand that, you know, having the baby is a better thing than, you know, aborting the baby. And if you have the baby, you know, we can help you deal with the consequences of that. And we're not going to stigmatize you. And we're going to help you to still be a healthy, productive human being in your life. And you're going to be able to go on and, you know, go to college and get a career and have a family. But let's just adopt your child out, you know. I don't see why adoption is not a choice.
Well, and remember when Obama said, when he was talking about the abortion issue, you know, oh, well, if, you know, a girl makes a mistake, then he doesn't want to have her punished with a baby.
He didn't want his own daughters to be punished with a pregnancy.
Right.
Oh,
one,
yeah.
One of the things I want to ask on the abortion issue, because, I mean, it's definitely going to be very tough to fight against. And, of course, everyone here knows that I'm pro-life as well, or at least I consider myself anti-abortion, less than what people would consider pro-life, because I'm also pro-death penalty. And many say that if you're, you know, pro-life, you have to be against the death penalty, which I disagree with. But that being said, it's definitely a hard nut to crack. So what's your thoughts on this? And this is kind of a pet peeve of mine when it comes to abortion and even with child support laws is, you know, if a woman gets, you know, pregnant, the male has no say whatsoever what happens, but yet, you know, once the baby is born, and I think he should have financial responsibility. But I say, well, if he has financial responsibility, you know, after the child is born, and as I, you know, said, I believe he should, he ought to, then would there be a way to make some kind of legislation that would give the father some kind of rights in the decision-making on whether, you know, in the decision-making of having an abortion?
Well, you know what I think? A lot of women, if they had a male who was going to support them with the pregnancy, they probably would not end up with an abortion. But what happens is in these abortion situations, sometimes the men are not supportive of it. Sometimes the men are encouraging it. And I'm not going to say in all cases, but I think that I don't want further legislation, but I do understand that there is that component of unfairness that happens for men, that they have no say in having, you know, the woman having a baby. So, you know, it's a moral conundrum that we're in with the situation of abortion. We can't force people into moral choices.
No, but we can force people to obey the strictures of the Constitution. And what it comes down to is this. Robert, there's logic behind this. I can see why, even though I don't support the death penalty, because government makes mistakes all the time, there's no remediation. A person who is convicted of a heinous offense and sentenced after all the appeals, trial of a jury of his peers, after due process, is different from a baby who has not even committed an act, much less committed a crime, much less been accused, much less had a trial, much less been convicted. And as far as the rights of parents, that's the key right there. If it's not a lump of flesh, if, as David said, that this is a person from the moment of conception, that is a person who has standing under constitutional law. That person has a right to life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And as a child, that means they have a right to somebody in custodial care of them. Now, that's not always the mother, and that's not always the father. It can be a grandparent. It could be an adopted parent. It can be a foster parent. It could be the state, which is nearly always a bad choice. But if that is a person, then the husband, the father, the biological father, not only has a financial obligation under current law once the baby is born, but they also have standing to go to court and say, Judge, I would like custody of this child, or I disagree with this aspect of the child's raising. I think it's dangerous or bad for the child, or I'd like to see the child have this opportunity. You can go through the process properly as a father and as a mother, and you can't do that if it's a lump of flesh, but you can if it's a child. So that would solve everything, and it doesn't apply to morals at all.
Indeed, and I do see that there's about 8 minutes left of the live time, folks. So if you'd like to listen in or chime in to the extended version here on the show, go ahead and call in at 347-945-7428. So you can listen to the extended version as well, which happens in about 8 minutes. And if you did not call in this time, before then, unfortunately, the show will unceremoniously drop you from listening to the rest of it. So go ahead and do that in the next 8 minutes if you don't want to listen to that part. But, of course, if you can't, because I know in some places here, Eastern Time, it is late for some folks. But, of course, you're more welcome to listen to the archive, which the extended version will be recorded as well as with the live portion of the show, where, of course, you can listen to it later. And, of course, also, if you would, share the link and downloads with folks so that they can get this information as well, and in support of David Hale, and spread that out there as well. So we'll go ahead, and I just wanted to get that out. Go ahead, Dan. I do have to check on someone who is in the queue and
okay.
See about them coming in. Go ahead.
I have a question for you, Mr. Hale. Listen, you're saying all the right things. And Kinzinger, he says a lot of the right things. And we've been electing people, some of whom stand strong. Rand Paul, you mentioned, Ted Cruz, you mentioned, Mike Lee. They're strong. And they're over at CPAC. And CPAC just got up and applauded Chris Christie yesterday. I mean, for God's sakes. The guy in my neighboring state of New Jersey, who is the farthest thing from a constitutionalist, although for Jersey, he's awfully conservative. So what I want to ask you, and I'm not trying to, this is not a got you question, but this is something that's on the back of all of our minds. Some of the people that we elect stay true. Some of them, maybe like Mr. Kinzinger, go along to get along or make choices that are less than what we think that they promised us to get in. Tell us why. We can be assured that you will stay true to these ideals.
Yeah, and that's a good question, and I've been asked that question a number of times, and I've had to address that question a number of times, knowing that Kinzinger has backtracked and walked back and broken his promises on pretty much everything. Why wouldn't I do it? Here's a simple answer. I've been a Tea Party leader for 5 years. I've been a committed conservative for 25 years, and my ideas have been tested through the fire. I have had to stand by my ideas against physical assault by the Occupy movement, media assaults, mass, just all sorts of turmoil, and I've got the scars to prove that I will stand by my ideas, that I'm not just going to throw them away once I cross the Potomac River, that I'm going to be there for those ideas and follow through with those ideas. I've gone through the fire for these ideas, and there's no way in God's green earth that I'm going to back down on these ideas or back off of these ideas after having gone through the fire. It would be like, you know, asking a penguin to turn into a shark, or asking a penguin to turn into a walrus. I'm not a walrus. I'm a penguin.
Well, we'll get on to global warming later with all those Arctic animals.
Yeah.
Listen, what it sounds like you're saying is that your price is not power or money. Everyone has a price. I don't care who you are. Everybody is capable of being corrupted, or at least tempted. Everyone is capable of redemption, so I'm not giving up on all those progressives out there who may be listening. I was a progressive. You mentioned in the first part of the show that you're not getting PAC money. You're not looking for, and that's good from a point of view. And you said that if you take their money, you'll have to listen to them, and they'll try and manipulate you. You understand that you, no matter what, you're still going to have to listen to them, because you have to listen to everybody as a congressman, and everybody's going to try and manipulate you. So,
well,
what I would ask is this: if you have a PAC that's honest, you know, not, and they say, we're willing to give you this money because of your stance on the Second Amendment, which is something I'm very strong at. I'm going to all these open carry rallies, carrying a shotgun, speaking out. If they say, we're going to give you this money, and all we want is you to be pro-Second Amendment, as a for instance, and you take their money, and then you are pro-Second Amendment, but perhaps you're not so Second Amendment in the way they like, the worst thing that can happen to you, David, is that they won't give you money the second term. But your voters will know that you meant what you said. And principle counts an awful lot more than rhetoric.
I might end up being the poorest congressman in Congress because of this. Because, you know, I've already said publicly that, for example, with the abortion issue, I don't need to have a super PAC, an abortion super PAC, chase me down and force me to sign on to something or pay me to sign on something when it comes to this issue of abortion. I'm going to do it with or without them coming to talk to me, and I'm not going to require that they pay me for me to do it or to sign on to something. And it's the same way with any of the other, you know, issues that I believe and trust in. I'm not going to, you know, send fundraisers out to contact all the big corporate super PACs and have them donate their $10,000 to my election campaign. I'm going to do what's right, number one, because I do want to correct something. I don't have to listen to any of them, whether they give me money or not. I do not have to listen to them.
Well,
I am responsible to is my constituents. I am solely responsible to my constituents.
As far as listening, it's never a bad idea to listen to everybody no matter what they're saying.
I agree.
Know what they're going to say. It might be useful.
I agree. But
now, if you don't have the money, and I am impressed by your campaign, the website is amazing. The stuff that you're doing is amazing. As a solo effort, it boggles my mind at how you're doing it. What does your volunteer staff look like? Because you could use a volunteer, anyone out there in his district, he could use a volunteer campaign manager.
Yeah, if I had a volunteer campaign manager, that would be nice. But I have people volunteering throughout the district, especially from tea parties. I've got the awesome person named Carolyn Gerwin out in Livingston County. I've got another awesome person out in Iroquois County named Barb Offal. So these women are Tea Party leaders, and they've been staunchly beside me and behind me in getting my information out down there, giving me advice, talking to me about issues, and passing out brochures and helping me get into meetings within their counties. Another guy named Ben Ordonez, another woman named Amanda Norris, out in Dixon, Illinois, where, the birthplace of Ronald Reagan. Well, he was born near Dixon, Illinois, but they have, it's Reaganville, basically. So, I've got those kind of volunteers. But as far as, door-to-door volunteers, they're harder to come by, especially since we've had this bad weather.
Oh, yeah.
It's been below zero in northern Illinois for the last, 60 days here in Illinois, and it's hard to get out and walk those districts. And today was one of the first days, I think it reached 40 degrees in
here
the last
too.
3 months.
Yeah, it was actually 42 degrees, and my heating oil tank is just about empty, and I was praying. It was like that the Festival of Lights, the Hanukkah celebration, where the oil lasted 8 days.
Yep.
It was only supposed to last one. It's a miracle. And
I
saw liquid water today on the street. I couldn't believe it.
Yep.
Well, now you mentioned the penguins and the polar bears, and we're talking about cold weather. What are your thoughts on the confirmed consensus of the established, what do they call it now, climate change?
Yeah.
Because it's getting warmer?
Well, one of my problems is that the place where the climate change is actually closely studied is in England, and the place where they studied it, all the data was falsified by their scientists out there and disseminated
mm-hmm.
throughout the world. That's one of my biggest problems with the so-called climate issue. But beyond that, when they have these consensus of 1,300 scientists or whatever, or 30,000 scientists, they never include the conservatives in those numbers, and they're always purposefully excluded. So until we come up with some solid, honest data and unbiased information from a true consensus of politically neutral scientists, I have to say I don't agree with any conclusions from anybody, because we don't really have any true solid data. And so therefore, I wouldn't even consider supporting, something like cap and trade. So it's
well, that's good. Now, the Heritage Foundation, which I'm you mentioned Heritage and Heritage Action. I'm active with them as a sentinel. The Heritage Foundation has proposed legislation that they think is a good idea. And it's not getting very far, but it would originate in the House, and it deals with regulation. That any regulation, this ties into the spending power, the power of the purse that you would have a big part of as one of the representatives in the Congress. That's where it all originates. That anything that's going to cost $1 billion or more, and Lord knows they can waste a million here or there or 100 million, but a billion or more as a start would require congressional approval. So if they can't just come up with the EPA and say, you're going to have to do this because of the little snipe snail or whatever the heck that little creature is that was never there 100 years ago. I assume you would support and co-sponsor something like that, or do you have a different idea? Or
I would be for that. We can't starve the people, for example, of California of water because they're trying to save us, a little regional.
The snail darter in Imperial Valley, where all our vegetables come from.
That snail is really a result of microevolution. And just so you know what microevolution is just a variation of species. So, you can have a Chihuahua and you can have a Doberman, and it's just, that's a variation of species. They're still dogs. So this little snail darter is just a variation of species within the class or whatever of all these snails. And so they've called it an endangered species because, that little snail just happened to be a result of microevolution or variation of species. And so now what they're doing is they're starving, the whole eastern part of Central California of water. It's ridiculous,
Which starves the Imperial Valley of jobs, family farmers out of business, and starves us because we can't get fresh vegetables, and the fresh vegetables we get cost us a fortune. By the way, I did look it up. The snail darter just like most of the progressive things, is a lie, kind of, because it's actually a fish.
Okay.
I was looking that up right now. I couldn't
right.
believe it.
Well, gentlemen, I do want to hold on a second. I do want to bring someone in.
Oh, good.
Who? Yes, who's actually near and dear to our hearts, and we will bring her in. And that is Harriet. Thank you very much for coming to the show, Harriet. How are you?
You're welcome. You know I'm always on the show.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, that's okay. Hi, everybody. I, too, am a nurse, Congressman Hale. And getting back to this abortion issue, I have some thoughts on that. And this is what I want to bring up. I hear people shouldn't be pro-abortion, for abortion, whatever. However, the community and society should take responsibility and do something with a program in the community to counsel people, educate people. For example, I have been with the pregnancy program with Head Start for 5 years in my county. I had the pregnancy program in 2 counties. I had seen and worked with over 100 girls, mainly the unmarried, young girls, older people. And when the issue of abortion came up or I felt there was a thought, I immediately intervened with counseling and also went with a plan of action of what we were going to do for that baby and that mother after delivery. I worked with the hospitals. Also, we provided education throughout my program. And I'm not lying. I don't think I had anybody that had an abortion that I know of within my groups. So these are things I hear all the time. No, I don't approve of abortion. I would never, never work in an abortion clinic, but that's me personally. However, there are methods that people who are out there wanting to feel that's what, because it's their feelings, this is what their principles are, and that everybody else should abide by how they feel. And the issues that they bring up to support it, I'm not very impressed, because with a pregnant woman, you just don't say, well, you can't have an abortion or you shouldn't have, which, of course, I agree with, but you have to take the measures to support that woman and that family and that baby after the delivery all the way through. The other yep. thing is I want to know how come the law could be made to honor any one religion and politics. The people to honor, I don't think that there should be a law in our country to favor any one religious belief or right.
Right. No, I agree with that. We have religious liberty here, so.
Yes.
Yep.
I'm done.
Cool. Yeah.
I said my piece.
Cool.
And
yeah,
I gave examples. I gave examples, and I also educated a little bit on what the community can do to intervene, with the health department, with the doctors, with the hospitals, with the social workers, and they can do a lot to intervene with that issue.
Yeah. Well,
one of the things that I remember in, at least here, my area, when there's a lot of talk about the abortion issue in Obama, and it was actually, and I'm talking about the, I believe the first time that Obama was running, when he was running against McCain and Palin, is, I believe he actually got it was a small majority, but he actually got a small majority of the Catholic vote. Because, and I even talked to, some Catholics who supported him, even though they would say that they were pro-life, but the reason why, an anti-abortion, they would say, but they still would vote for Obama because they were contending that although he wasn't looking to, make abortion illegal. He was going to work on what the causes are, namely their contention was, because of poverty, things of that nature.
It's false compassion. He doesn't really care.
Right, that he was going to work on what the causes of abortion are, thus limiting them. Go ahead.
Yeah, making it illegal isn't going to prevent it. It's what you got to do to support the woman and the family, because I have 5 years of experience with that and prior years with working with the pregnancy program and maternity clinics, and that is what we can do to get involved and to cut down on it. Because I had an experience not long ago with an 88-year-old lady who I had in the emergency room here, and she must have felt she was dying, but she didn't. And she broke down, and she told me, she says, when I was 18 years old, I had an abortion.
Well, you know
and
what?
If an abortion costs
$1,000 to do,
yes.
A woman is probably going to be less likely to want to pursue an abortion. So that's why, I would like to, require an abortion clinic to have to meet the same requirements as same-day surgery.
Absolutely.
Cause their clinics to have to, charge a lot of money for abortions. But besides that, I understand what you're saying. If you don't, if you make it illegal, it's not going to prevent it. I disagree with you slightly on that, and there's two aspects to that disagreement. One aspect is that constitutionally, under our system of government, we don't make laws from the bench. And if we look at the Constitution says that the legislative branch makes the laws, and the president signs them, and then the Supreme Court gets to interpret them. And so there was never any legislation that was signed for the Supreme Court to interpret. But what they did do was interpret the Fourth Amendment, the right to privacy. And they said, well, a woman has a right to privacy. So what happens behind the door, the closed doors of an abortion clinic, if it's an abortion that happens back there, then a woman has a right to have that, done in privacy. So that's what Roe versus Wade is based upon, a right to privacy. And so there is no right to abortion granted in the Constitution. And I know you're going to say, making it illegal is not going to prevent it. But the reality is that the whole statistic about thousands of women conducting coat hanger abortions in back alleys, that was a lie. That was a statistical lie. It was not ever true from anybody. It was made up by a guy who actually finally admitted that it was a lie, but the media proliferated that lie in order to move their agenda forward the Planned Parenthood and liberal agenda of allowing women to have an abortion for whatever reasons they had. So I don't agree that we shouldn't deal with it from a legislative perspective. We should. But on top of it, what you're saying about providing support, trying to help to destigmatize a woman who's pregnant, or letting her know, okay, we have a support infrastructure for you once you're pregnant to either care for your child while still going to college and or put your baby up for adoption. Women, I think, get abortion out of fear. In large part, because they feel like they're alone, and they shouldn't feel like they're alone. They feel like they're going to be the one stuck with a situation that they don't necessarily want for the rest of their lives. But I tell you what, every woman that I know, as soon as they look on the eyes of their child, they know right away, well, this isn't the situation. This is an amazing gift that I am now totally in love with and totally happy that I didn't, on an abortion room floor. So, if we want to paint the abortion in the terms of political rhetoric of a war on women, then we'll always see abortion, and the left wing will always get their way, and women will always be reduced to fear and motivated by the fear of being left alone, unsecured, without anybody to take care of them, or at least watch out for their best interests.
Now,
watch out for their best interests.
putting aside the idea that of the progressive liberal media with their talking points and their lies, there is a reasonable reservation that a lot of middle-of-the-road people have when it comes to conservative views. They feel that because their side, or the side that's in power, the progressives of both parties, have used the government to force legislation that enforces a particular brand of morality, that our side would do the same thing. And this is something I want to make very clear and ask your view on this. The government has actually enforced a degradation of morality. They have enforced, they have used the tax structure and the benefit structure and the criminal structure to enforce brutality and uncaringness and promiscuity and all these negative moral things that take a society apart. And I'm not saying that any one person doesn't have the right to do what they want to do with their life, but most of the things that need to change in America, in my view, are not going to change because Congress does something and passes a new law. The only way it's going to change is if Congress repeals laws and gets them out of the way and allows the American people to make their own individual choices and individual voluntary choices within groups. So in other words, I want to just reassure people and ask if you agree that just because I have a particular viewpoint or you have a particular viewpoint, we're not going to insist that every single person owns a gun or that every single person becomes a devout follower of God or that every single person suddenly is in favor of all of our conservative views. They have the right to be liberal. They have the right to be whatever they want to be. But the government shouldn't be picking in winners and losers. So what are you willing to get rid of? What are you willing as a congressperson with the power of the purse under our Constitution, what are you willing to say, you know what, I'm going to write a law or co-sponsor a law or vote for a law that says we're getting rid of the following things that government shouldn't be doing. What shouldn't we be doing?
Well, get real quick, gentlemen, go ahead, David, and then Cindy will have you chime in. Go ahead, David.
Uh-oh. Where'd David go?
Oh, dear.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I was on mute for a second there. I apologize.
That's okay.
I don't know if I have a list of things that I can give you off the top of my head, but I like to think about things in terms of the principles that we live by. And one of them is that if we – the left wing will legislate morality in their direction through the law, okay? So when they say, well, you can't legislate morality, the reality is that the left wing legislates morality via the government all the time. And so on the abortion issue in particular, if we're not going to legislate morality toward our direction, then the left wing is going to legislate morality towards their direction. There's always a struggle in that. And here's the reason why there is that struggle. The left wing sees government as their religion. The left wing oftentimes doesn't see God and, whatever religious perspective you want to choose, they don't see God or real religion as a religion. They see government as a religion, and their high priests are, they're government officials and so on and so forth. So we have to understand that we play into their religious kind of paradigm, their commitment to their religion, by allowing them to force us to legislate morality through the government. So, but unfortunately, it's the world that we live in right now. And
government not necessarily,
is so pervasive.
David. When looking on your website, one of the things you mentioned is that you're against Common Core, and here in Pennsylvania, we're fighting this very same struggle. It's very difficult, and it's these self-appointed experts backed by big money from George Soros and Bill Gates and this so-called Governors Association, which is a private enterprise, pushing us to dumb down education even further and turn it into straightforward progressive propaganda. What about just simply, as an example, saying the Constitution does not require, under even the Health and Welfare Clause, that we have a national Department of Education. So there's plenty of state departments of education and school boards all over this country. We're just going to eliminate all funding for the and eliminate the Department of Education, period, as a start.
Well, and so here's my – and I totally agree, number one. But we have to understand human nature when it comes to this. You know, when we talk about eliminating whole departments like the Department of Education or eliminating the IRS or eliminating the EPA, when we talk about eliminating these big departments, those are massive changes that people are immediately afraid of. They're scared of massive changes. Now, would I like to eliminate the EPA? Yeah, because we cover the EPA through, you know, the states. Every state has their own EPA. Would I like to eliminate the Department of Education? Yeah, I'd eliminate it tomorrow because every state has its own Department of Education. Eliminate the IRS today? Yes. Every state has its own ability to tax, and, you know, we can simplify our tax code when we don't need it. But human beings do not adapt to large-scale, in-your-face, shock-and-awe kind of change very well. And so they become familiar and comfortable with these big government agencies, and they get scared, and they think, well, what am I going to do? What are we going to do? What are we – it's so much a part of our lives. So –
I don't know anybody who actually deals with the Department of Education in Washington directly. We all know our school boards. We all know the teachers of our children. We all know the principals. We vote for our school boards. How hard would it be to get rid of it, especially when the other side is pushing radical in-your-face change with Obamacare and with all these other things that they're doing? They're pushing so hard that to merely chip away at their edges – they had 100 years to get us here. Do we have the time to go gradual?
Right. The evidence of how hard it would be to get rid of it, the evidence is that it still exists because most of us want to eliminate it.
Who's proposed the law to get rid of it?
Well, every time we talk about eliminating it, you know, Rick Perry gets up there and talks about eliminating it during a presidential debate. And the next day he is castigated and crucified in the media because he wants to eliminate a massive department.
What makes you think that the media won't castigate and crucify everything you do?
Well, I understand. But the next day, when he does that, the entire country comes out and publicly he's opposed and nobody agrees. And you don't get a public consensus. It will require people that are willing to go into Congress and do such a thing. I'm willing to go in and do such a thing, but I also have to look at life realistically. Okay?
Well, keep in mind something, though.
Real quick, I do want to come back to this, but I know Cindy would like to chime in.
Sorry.
So let's go ahead and bring her in, guys.
Well, first of all, on that issue, I just want to say I think the Common Core is doing more to help us than not, because it's actually opening the eyes of the local people like in our county. We've gone down to our school board, I mean, with our pitchforks and our you know, our tar and feathers. I mean, we were ready to crucify those people for bringing Common Core in there. And Rick Scott, who's up for re-election this year, is getting a huge amount of trouble from his far-right group because of Common Core. He's the one that originally was allowing Common Core to come in here. But I think it was him. But anyway, he didn't do anything about it. But anyhow, so it may be that Common Core is actually our helper because people may start waking up to the fact that we cannot have a centralized federal government telling us what kind of education is best for our counties in particular. Now, as far as the right to life issue and stuff, There are, first of all, Harriet, there's many, many all across the country Women's Counselor Center, and they're doing a great job, and we should be helping to support them. But there is one thing that our congressman can do about that issue, and it is to go ahead and define human life, the beginning of human life. The court decision, Roe v. Wade, actually left that open. They said, look, the Supreme Court has no business saying when life begins. So for right now, we're ruling as a privacy issue. But if Congress ever does define when life begins, then this decision will be null and void. And he's accurate about that. So, yes, we can legislatively do something about this, and we should, because we have had 59 million babies killed since 1973, and there were nothing like that many abortions before abortion became legalized by the Supreme Court. So, yes, there is something we can do, and there's something we should do. And I get very upset when I hear people cry out, you can't legalize morality. Yes, I agree with you, Mr. Hale, that we legalize morality all the time. We say that it's illegal to kill a minnow. We say it's illegal to kill a snowy owl and the egg of a eagle. It's immoral to kill any endangered animal. We say that it's illegal to, the list can go on and on.
Just in my defense, what I did say was that if we don't legislate toward morality, the left wing is going to legislate against morality. So
I know what you're talking about, and you're absolutely correct. I was agreeing with you. I was agreeing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Now can I?
I was totally agreeing. But wait a minute. That's not really. Yeah. Wait. That's not really
okay.
What I asked. I do have a question for you, Mr. Hale.
Okay. Sure.
After all that opinion giving, Hannity lately has been in doing some good things. One thing he's doing is that, you know, he's doing this kind of back to work thing, this back to work program, and that's wonderful. But Hannity is also advocating, almost every day he talks about the Republicans need to come up with a list of things and come out like kind of like a Newt-like contract with America back in the 90s. They need to come forward, have a press conference, and have a whole bunch of them standing around there, all of our good, true conservative, patriot representatives up there in Congress. They need to get together, and they need to hold up a list and say, these are the 5 things or the 10 things that we're going to get done. You put us into the Senate. You keep us in control of the Congress. You get us in control of the Senate. And this is what we will do. And that would include, of course, a alternative to Obamacare. And I think that it needs to be completely wiped out, needs to be repealed. There is no hope for that thing. It is too entangled and too long, and there's so many hidden things in there. There's just no way you could just pick and pick and pick at it until you got it the way you wanted it. You need to just completely repeal it and replace it with something. And we have a lot of good ideas in Congress, and you said a few of them too. That needs to be addressed, probably number one thing on the list, and then go on down from there dealing with all these different subjects. Would you like to see our Congress do something like that, and would you be involved in that?
Oh, yeah, certainly. It would be nice to see Congress step up and publicly, you know, make a stand and want to move the flag and advance the flag, and I certainly would be involved in something like that, and I think it's common sense, but I think that what we need what I really want to see is action. And I know that getting up there and seeing that is, you know, it's nice and it's you know, it's good. It's a step in the right direction. But what I really want to see is action. And what I don't see out of Congress oftentimes is action after something like that. They say they're going to do something, but then they don't do it. And so
well,
we need people who are going to be active in Congress and people who are going to actually, you know, get into the nitty-gritty, sit down with the budget, sit down with whatever they got to sit down with, and do something. That's what we need.
Well, you know, Newt Gingrich did do that, though. He gave us the contract with America, and then he fulfilled it, and that's what got him in trouble with the elite Republican rhinos, and then they lambasted him.
And
but,
Clinton took credit for it.
Right, exactly. Clinton got all the credit. And you know what? If you guys did it during Obama's presidency, he would probably try to claim credit for it, too, even though, you know. But it takes somebody like Newt and his ability to maneuver in the background to get something like that done. But I think it really does need to be done. And by the way, before I stop, I just want to tell you, if you were accosted by occupiers, you have my vote automatically.
Yeah, I was assaulted twice by the occupiers, physically
that's
assaulted.
That's a badge. That is a badge that you need to wear proudly.
Yeah.
Did you punch him in the nose?
Nope. I was actually punched by a woman in a stomach.
A woman.
And
I wouldn't punch
her.
No.
And I was in front of the police, and they didn't do anything. And then I was physically shoved by a number of them during a situation where I was trying to get some video of Dick Durbin. So, I've had my encounters with the Occupy movement.
Well, at least they didn't, defecate on your vehicle or anything.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, let's go you back to Harriet, because I told her I'd bring her back in.
All right.
So go
all
ahead,
right.
Harriet. You want to say
something?
Just
what I want to pick up on Cindy's thoughts on the abortion and legal, and I do appreciate it, and I soak up everybody else's opinions, and then I go and I do my research to see which one comes out ahead. But anyway, and I was thinking with all this conversation is I am not favoring legislation declaring when the sanctity of life begins. They're going to work on their principles and their religion, and that's what they're going to look at.
No, Harriet, you know what, Harriet?
Wait a minute. Let me talk.
Wait a minute. Let Harriet, and then go ahead, Cindy, and then I'm going to chime in on something.
It's going to amount to a religious thing. If there's 50 people in Congress, you're going to get 50 different opinions, and they're going to cover their religions as to what they believe in their mind, what the sanctity of life begins. That is not legislation. That is up to God. And when
what
God
about science?
And when the sanctity of life is God, not science. The other thing.
That's wrong.
Wait a minute.
Go ahead, Harriet, and then Cindy, and then I think that was Dan, and then
I had heard no one talk about what is in, Wade versus Roe, that law goes back to the 1970s. That law addresses that the doctor and the patient have the right to confidentiality to make a decision if the woman wants an abortion or not. I don't know of anything in that law, unless I'm wrong, that addresses the sanctity of life, or that a woman should, or that abortion is illegal or legal. It addresses, from what I remember, the doctor and the patient's reality, and the right for the parent, the mother, to make the decision to have an abortion or not after consulting with the doctor. Because furthermore, in the 1970s, it was not unusual to work in a hospital and see on the surgical list, abortion is going to be scheduled tomorrow in surgical suite 8 for so-and-so-and-so. It was not unusual at that time. So And I had not heard any further discussion of that, but if you go to the law, you can, it's plain and clear. Now, getting back to the sanctity of life, that's my opinion. Don't say I'm wrong. I'm not saying you're wrong, and don't say I'm wrong. I don't feel that the sanctity of life, from the way I know it and the way I work with it, has anything to do with legislation. Maybe the rules surrounding it, or the hospitals or what, but not the fact of when life starts and at what age and anything like that. I don't, it's just not,
right.
No, it's just okay, not right.
So
that's just me.
Okay, and that's
going
so
ahead.
We understand people here.
Talk.
Okay,
this
we understand
is,
people
David.
Here is going to have differing opinions, and I'm going to chime in a little bit. Then we'll get to Cindy, then you, Dan, and then we'll bring it to David. Is that philosophically, and this is pretty basic. You know, something can't. You know, for me, on a premise, because I do consider myself an objectivist, and I think everyone here understands what that is. So. That being said, something cannot exist and not exist at the same time. Very basic premise, okay? And that being said, you know, when one talks about the sanctity of life or when life begins, if the sanctity of life is going to be tied to where life begins, to be a moment, there has to be a moment where, you know, this creation is life, okay? And because going back to the first basic premise, is that it can't not be life and then be life at the same time. There has to be that moment when it is. That's why I brought up science. Okay, once science says, okay, this is a human life, this is a human life, because it can't be a human life and not a human life at the same time, because that's objectivism. I mean, that's just being subjective. It can't. That's why it can't work. That's why you can't have it. Well, this person thinks life starts at this point. This is one person says life begins at that point. It's not a religious issue. It's actually a scientific issue and or a philosophical issue, because it cannot be and not be at the same time. There has to be a time when it's a life. Once that is determined, and if there is the sanctity of life, once you determine that what that embryo or whatever is life, then is when you have your time to say, look, if you're going to have the sanctity of life at that point in time when it is a life, then if you're going to legislate to protect life as per the Constitution, right in the Constitution is life, and if that is human life, by the Constitution, it already has that right to not be destroyed. So that being said, go ahead, Cindy, and then we'll go to you, Dan, and then we'll bring it to David, and then back to you, Harry. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead, Cindy.
I'm not really concerned about. I'm not concerned. I am actually. I personally, as a Christian, I am very concerned about the sanctity of human life. But I'm not expecting my government to be concerned with the sanctity of human life. I only care about the definition of life and human life specifically. Our textbooks had for years and years defined life. And if you just take that definition and then you take all of the research we have on what's going on inside the womb, we have video inside the womb, we have pictures inside the womb, things that we did not have in 1973 when this court decision was made. We have the scientific evidence to prove that a baby inside the mother's womb is human life, and we can define it scientifically. We do not have to bring, in fact, I don't want religion to be brought into it at all. I want total science definition of human life, and that is what Congress can deal with, and that is according to what the decision of the Supreme Court was back in 1973. It is part of the opinion of the judges of the main judge. Oh, I forget what the judge who writes the piece, the whole decision. That was part of his decision.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah, he had stated that they could only deal with, this, as the Supreme Court, they could only deal with the issue of the right to privacy, the doctors and the patient's right to interact without anyone talking. Okay, he could not deal with anything but that. But he did also admit in the paper, in the decision, that if it was ever determined by the proper organization, which would have been the Congress, is what he said, okay, then this ruling, he said this ruling, Roe v. Wade, would be null and void, because now we have a definition of the beginning of life, and then it becomes murder when you kill what's inside the womb. That's the truth. We can do it by scientific evidence, and that's what we ought to do.
Now, the idea of a slippery slope that so many people have talked about doesn't just include abortion. If we think to other regimes throughout history, and not just modern regimes like the Nazis, which documented everything so thoroughly, there were many regimes where they would accuse some group of people of being somehow less than human. And the medical ethicists of the progressive movement today are carrying on in the tradition of George Bernard Shaw and Margaret Sanger, who were eugenicists and racists and murdering. They were murderous. They didn't, I don't know if they killed anybody personally. Saying that it's okay to have a late-term abortion after the child is born. First, it was suggested within a few days. Now, they were bold enough to say within a few weeks, within a few years. One at the University of Pennsylvania recently said up to age 10. Now, if that's not murder, what is? And in Obamacare, under the death panels that weren't supposed to exist, but they already have this unappointed board that's going to be put in place of medical procedure vetting, that it's either okay or it's not. They can determine that it's not, and they can deny it. And Congress will only have a brief window of a very few short months to come up with some better way of cutting the money. Otherwise, they don't get the right to say anything at all. That's what's in the law. It takes away Congress's power to legislate if Obamacare stays. The idea that they can say that some group of people, whether it's babies or old people or sick people, is somehow less than human and therefore not deserving of the protections of constitutional liberty, is the very thing that will be used and has been used over and over again to expand into other groups. The Nazis did not start with the Jews. They started with mental defectives, as they called them.
That's right.
And then they moved on to communists. And they were going after Jews, but at the same time, they decimated a much larger percentage of the gypsy population of Europe than any other population because there were less of them. I hesitate to say that it's about sanctity, implies a religious belief. Life is
That's
life.
Right.
Human life
right.
is paramount. God
right.
is the one who gave us this life, and the Constitution is merely there, if we but followed it, to make certain that we restrain government from infringing on our basic rights. The first is life, and the second is protection of life, which is the Second Amendment. And the third is your views on life, which is the First Amendment, who you associate with, what you speak about, what you believe in your heart. And all those other ones are, again, strictures on what government cannot do. The Fourth Amendment says the government can't intrude on your privacy. The Fifth Amendment says they can't just declare you an enemy combatant and blow you up with a drone. So, David, I know that it would be an uphill battle, and I know that being politic and as you say in your writings, strategic and using long-term goals, doing like Rand Paul is trying to do, if this makes sense. And you don't want to inflame everybody, but what Cindy said about Common Core is true, and what is happening with Obamacare is true.
Can I just talk about the abortion issue real quick?
Yes, please. I'm sorry. This is your show. Go ahead.
Yeah. Let me just comment about the abortion issue before we move on to other issues. Number one, in the absence of an arbitrator, that arbitrator of morality, who we would consider God, we have to find an arbitrator of to determine issues such as this, as when life begins. So we go ahead and we default to where the left wing to choose who their arbitrator is, and they choose government to be their arbitrator. We don't like to choose government as our arbitrator. We like to choose our personal belief systems as our arbitrator, and our personal belief system is based upon the responsibility to God. So we like to choose that. But because the left won't cooperate with that, we say, okay, Congress, you can arbitrate on this issue of life. So as a nurse myself, I know that as soon as a egg is fertilized by a sperm, you put 23 chromosomes together, you get 46. You have a human life. At conception, you have a human life. And then very shortly after conception, you have meiosis and mitosis. When those take place, you can rest assured that the cellular division that takes place, that is life. But then when a woman discovers she's pregnant, which is generally not until after about 4 to 6 weeks after conception will a woman discover she's pregnant, because it's almost undetectable before that unless you suspect something and you're looking for something and you start taking pregnancy tests every day. You won't know. So the reality is that at 43 days, a child's heartbeat can be heard in the womb. That is life, okay? If you can hear a heartbeat, that is life at 43 days.
Yes,
so
I agree.
If you have a right to, you don't have a right to privately murder somebody in the privacy of your own home, a fully grown adult male human being or a female human being, you don't have the right to privately murder them, okay? But we have a right to privately murder a child based upon a non-legislative law. So we keep calling it a law. Roe versus Wade is not a law. It is a precedent. And we got to understand, if we're going to be constitutional human beings, it is a precedent. That is not law. Precedent is not law. It's just something that a judge can look at and say, there's a precedent over here, so we're going to follow that precedent that was set. That
right,
is not
exactly
a law. Laws are made by a legislator. Laws are made legislatively by Congress. That's who makes laws. There's no law giving a woman a right to choose to abort a baby. So there's no law giving a woman a right to privately murder a baby. So what we say is, what we would like to do is we would like to define life as being at conception, so that once we define life being at conception, now you have a life that you are not allowed to privately murder any longer based upon Roe versus Wade. Those are the principles by which I would follow, and those are the principles if we really truly want to believe that we believe in the Constitution, that we as constitutional Americans should follow also.
You know, I wish I could move to your district and vote for you, just based on what you just said.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that 100%. And also, after we nurses have taken the embryology courses and classes that people generally aren't aware of, and so we understand the conception, we understand the heartbeat, we understand the growth of the fetus and the development and the organs and all that, that many people do not know. So it is up to us to educate them that that is a real life thing that is in the womb, and it is growing and breathing, and it comes out a beauty. And this has been so wonderful with my moms, and it's been effective. And yes, and I've been there during the delivery, and that baby comes out. I can't describe it. And when it's put in, when the mom holds the baby and when the family holds the baby, I mean, I can just go on and on and on. So I'm coming from the same place you are, Congressman, and I absolutely, totally agree. And I think that we have to be in charge of our own morals, but we need to educate and support those that will make it They won't do any harm if they understand the principles of what is in the wound, what is growing, and what the support that they will have after the baby's born.
Yep. And with that, folks, I guess I got to do a time clock here because we do have only about 10 minutes left of the show. And so what I'm going to have to do at this time is to start to close things out. Definitely one of those shows that went really quickly.
I'm going to say thank you and good night, and I'm just going to listen, and I'm not going to say anymore.
We love you, Harriet.
Well, I appreciate you calling in, as always, Harriet.
Thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure, and I appreciate Congressman Hale very much, and I wish you good luck with your campaign.
Yeah, I'm not a congressman yet, but thank you so much.
Well, we hope so. We certainly do.
That's exactly right. Okay, well, then we'll go back to you, Cindy, if you have any parting comments, and then we'll go to Dan. And, of course, we'll leave the last parting comments with our guest, David Hale, and then I'll proceed to close out the show. Go ahead, Cindy.
Well, I happen to think that the abortion issue and the EPA issues and the tax issues and the government control issues that are coming up right now all stem from the Agenda 21 agenda. I believe that there really is a concerted effort by an elite group of people throughout the world, and they are intertwined, not just the United States, that seeks to bring us under a one-world order. And I think they have been open enough about it that we should believe it by now. They don't even try to hide it anymore.
Yeah.
And, in order to make it work, they have to get rid of a large population. I think that has a lot to do with abortion, and I think it has to do with this climate change thing, because we don't have any clear data that proves that we have global warming or climate change above and beyond the natural progression of ups and downs in our weather. We certainly don't have any evidence that the change is caused by man. Climate change is a tool of the purveyors of Agenda 21. There's a reason for running farmers out of business. That's so that government can and its cronies can have total control over all farmland, so that they can supposedly distribute food fairly. But as we know from Russia and China and all the other communist nations that have taken over their food sources and their lands, tens of millions of people die in the process of that. And so it's getting to where it is extremely serious. We're at a stage in their agenda, in their plan that they have been trying to do for centuries, really, but especially in the last few decades, they're presenting this agenda even more and more so and almost becoming open about it. Obama's administration has been more open than any other to say exactly what they want to do. I hope that if you get in, first of all, and I hope, second of all, you'll work quickly, because I don't think we have a lot of time. And thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you, Cindy, as well, as always. Let's go ahead and go to Dan, because we're running out of time. Sorry, guys.
I'll make it as brief as possible, because I do want to give Mr. Hale a chance to, fully – I appreciate your patience with us, David. Looking at your website, there are so many issues, and listening to the first hour, that we haven't even touched on, because it wasn't a sidetrack at all. We were talking about something that was so dear to all of our hearts, which is human life. But you mentioned on your website all these issues, and the two that seem most important to me are constitutional conservative and oath-keeping. You're going to be taking an oath, assuming that you can win this uphill battle, to support, uphold, and defend the Constitution of the United States. If you're willing to do that, then I think the voters in your district have a champion on their side. And the one thing on your website that would give me any pause at all, I understand that politics is a matter of changing the moving the goalposts a little bit. Progressives did, but as Cindy said, we're real close to the edge of something really bad. And if they try something really bad, then there's going to be really bad results for the American people. I don't want to see that. So you say you won't go to Congress with a hammer or a big stick. I want you to go to Congress, and I want you to go with a hammer and a big stick. I want you to cut and slash things that they should not do. There is plenty of stuff that the federal government does need to do and need to do properly. For instance, you're in the Army. That absolutely, I have no problem with that. And foreign policy issues that we didn't touch upon, immigration issues, there are all these things that you will be voting for new laws and changes in law. But one of the most important things, and something that's almost never done, is repealing old law that doesn't agree with our Constitution. I'm mm-hmm. convinced that if we get rid of those laws and regulations that are none of the federal government's business, that 300-plus million Americans out there can come up with individual solutions and try them. And some will fail, and some will succeed, and the ones that succeed we'll use as models, and we'll succeed. And with that, plenty of time for you.
Go ahead, David. Get a couple minutes.
Yeah, so I would say this. Talking about going to Congress with a hammer and a big stick is different than talking about going to Congress with an axe and a machete. And if I go to Congress, I'm not planning on going to Congress and hammering people and yelling and screaming and carrying on and dramatic and bellicose. That's hammer and big stick right there.
Okay.
That's not my personality. That's not my plan. That's not what I want to do. And the problem is that people think that that's what Tea Partiers are. They think that Tea Partiers are loud, dramatic, wild-eyed, crazy lunatic nuts that, are going to take out a baseball bat and start bashing people's heads in. That's the perception that they've created for the Tea Party. Every time there's a shooting in America, a mass shooting, immediately, oh, are they in the Tea Party? Immediately, the Tea Party is blamed. And so, part of being a congressman is being a diplomat. Part of being a congressman is being a socially savvy human being when you're dealing in human interactions. And so it's partially assuaging people's fears, but it doesn't mean that I would not go to Congress with a machete and an axe and then take the machete and the axe out. And if at the first chance I get to sign on to a bill that eliminates the IRS, sign on. First chance I get to sign on to a bill that eliminates the EPA, sign on. First chance I get to, at any of those big, Department of Education or Commerce or the Nuclear Regulatory, or not the Nuclear Regulatory, but the Energy Department, sign on. But the question is there's only so much that
one
congressman
can do. We're going to run out of time here. I hate to interrupt you, David, but we're going to run out of time. We'll be cutting out in about a minute, so I want to thank you very much for coming in. I definitely wish we had more time.
Sure.
The primary is the 18th of March. I want to wish all the luck. Please come back and keep us posted. So I want to thank everyone for coming on tonight and look at us for Wednesday coming up the 12th. We're slotted to interview Jim Conda Jr., who is running against Boehner here in Ohio. So check that out on Wednesday, the 12th. So thank you very much, everyone, and have
thank
a good
you.
Night. And we'll see you next time. Sorry for to rush it off, but we will be just ending in mid-sentence, and I didn't want that to happen. So I'm going to go
I'd like
ahead
to say,
and,
David, you're an awesome, awesome candidate.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Good night, all. And I will end the show tonight, as I do every night, and that is...